cartoons from frozen in the past. Every week will be an animated bash. Woo! What a cartoon! What a cartoon! Maybe a short but mostly sharp. We'll talk, we'll analyze, exploring as we go. What a cartoon! What a cartoon! What a cartoon!
Hello everybody and welcome to What a Cartoon, where podcasting is like peeing your pants on purpose. I'm one of your hosts, Captain Guy with a hole punched through you, Bob Mackie, and this is an audio exploration of every cartoon ever. Who is here with me today, as always?
Henry Gilbert, who just like William is portrayed more openly gay than 20 years ago.
And who is our special guest who brought us this episode?
Founding member of the Lizard League, Andrew Bouvier.
And this month's episode is all about the Invincible episode, It's About Time.
Ah. It's about time.
He said it, everybody.
He said the line.
Yes, welcome to What a Cartoon. And joining us once again is our premium patron, Andrew Bouvier, I believe, who last brought us SWAT Cats, this time bringing us something from more recent history, the program Invincible from the Amazon Prime Network.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Thanks, guys.
Yes, Andrew, thank you very much. We liked talking about SWAT Cats last time, but this is... Yeah, 25 years later, yeah. After SWAT Cats.
A little bit of a tone shift.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, both are grown-up superhero adventure, or, you know, edgier action ones, though this is, SWAT Cats was edgy for children's TBS. This is edgy for now.
And they're both slightly anime, although I think SWAT Cats had more anime-style content. This is about 65% anime, maybe. Mm-hmm. SWAT Cats is maybe 85% anime.
Yeah.
I was seeing Invincible talked about in some animation discourse on Twitter recently about how it never got called a type of thing, but after, and this was last month's podcast, Avatar The Last Airbender, you end up with these Amera anime shows that all kind of, like, it's its own style, like this, and then Young Justice, and, like, most of the Marvel shows, and now this show is similar, and all of the, like, DC direct-to-video movies that don't look like Bruce Timm. They all kind of look like this, but I don't know if there's a word for it.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, you're right. I've seen a bunch of those DC ones off and on, and yeah, I didn't know how to describe it. I'm like, well, these aren't like those old classic, you know, Justice League Bruce Timm era ones, but I don't know what you, yeah, I don't know if it has a name or if it, but it's, and some of them are animated better than others, so it's, you know, it's not like you can just say the style is good or bad. It's just all entirely depends on the animation team and the direction.
I'm going to call it a superhero Amerime. Not clunky at all.
And it's funny, too, because there was like a direct-to-video one a few years ago called Catwoman Hunted that I really liked, but that turned the anime dial up like 20 more percent from this, that it actually looks more like anime, and it had more, it wasn't just a Korean studio, but actually a Japanese sub-studio then in charge of a Korean studio. So it seemed like they were leaning more into anime, but usually it's more you hire a Korean studio that probably worked on Avatar or shows that spun out of Avatar were inspired by it, and you say to them, oh, you do this for our show too, and they all, as I looked at the history of who worked on this and animated it that we'll get to, I was like, oh, they all worked on these types of shows, and that's why Invincible also looks like that type of show. It's almost like the secret Rick and Mortification of adult comedy cartoons. That it's like, they all look a little like Rick and Morty. But Andrew, what's your history with Invincible before I guess we get into to our own ones?
Mine actually is fairly recent. I never actually read the original, you know, comics from back in the early aughts. I knew of them at the time, but I just wasn't really into comics at that point. Again, you know, I was mostly in the 90s during the big boom, and I fell off a little bit. So I didn't really get into them. I would see them in the store, but I would usually get, I was buying some of the Walking Dead ones, which, you know, the other big Kirkman property, but I just was kind of like done, you know, it's kind of like, superhero fatigue at that point in my life. And then little I know how much more the fatigue would get.
Oh yeah.
In 10 to 20 years. But when it came out on Amazon Prime a few years ago, I decided, oh yeah, I think I'll finally check this out. And then I did mean to go back and get some of the comics and read them to see how the storylines compare, because I just, from what I've read online, I know that, you know, some things are moved around a bunch in the show compared to the comic, either, you know, and some things you know, added in, changed, you know, so I would be interested to see what the original one was like.
Well, and Bob, too, that you're probably pretty new to Invincible here.
Yeah, I didn't know the comics were as old as they are, and actually I was kind of getting back into comics in 2003, although I think I was only reading Fables and The Walking Dead, so I don't even think I saw this, or if I did, I didn't know what it was. And yeah, watching this for What a Cartoon is my first experience with this material. And while I was talking to Andrew before the show, I had the galaxy brain idea that's very obvious, where it feels like in the early aughts, so many creators were basically being on the same page about superheroes, because in 2003, we had this, we had The Incredibles, you know, it was already in the works, Venture Brothers, and then a few years later, The Boys comic would come out. So
yes.
I feel like everyone was just thinking the same thing about superheroes in the early aughts. And, of course, I guess the first wave of that was Watchmen and what followed. This feels like the second wave of post-Watchmen commentary.
No, absolutely. I think it also, like, the idea of an evil Superman, or, like, what if Superman went bad, was a thing that was done so much in the early aughts and late 90s. And then DC 10 years ago decided they'd start selling their own evil Superman, which is in the Injustice, first Injustice video game, and then it even turned into a popular comic series. And then The Boys, I think, mainstreams an evil Superman to people who don't read comic books more. And then by the time Invincible comes out, which was kind of ahead of the game on evil Superman stories, now it looks late to the game, like to an outsider who doesn't realize that. Same with a big part of Invincible Season 2 is multiverse stuff and guys going to other multiverses.
Yep.
And you might think, oh, they're really, he even has a green portal in it, just like in Rick and Morty. So you might think, oh, man, what a chaser of the popular thing. And that comic that they're adapting was from 2005. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of like how we covered multiverses on that Futurama episode, the Farnsworth Parabox. And actually, when I was watching that, Henry, I wasn't even thinking about multiverses. I just thought, like, oh, what a fun idea. And then when you brought it up in the podcast, I was like, oh, yeah, everything is this now. But it was done so well here that I didn't think about it being derivative.
Now, I really like how on the Secret Galaxy channel, YouTube channel that does a lot of pop culture histories, the host of it has explained so well of, like, the reason multiverses are now so big with the biggest entertainment movie companies that in existence, and not just things in geeky comic books, is because they learned that's how you get actors from other film universes in the main universe. Like, that's how you bring back old actors. Like, so they, once they learned that as the secret, that's when multiverses became everything. And now I'm kind of, well, I said I was tired of it, but then at the end of The Marvels, which is now old enough, I feel like I can spoil it, they're like, hey, here's the Beast from Marvel Comics, voiced by Kelsey Grammer, and he looks exactly like how you want the Beast to look. And I was like, back on board for Multiverse. I'm happy now.
The movie spat in your face, and then it was like, hey, piggies, eat up.
You know, I'd say it's more like it wasted your time. Spat in your face, that's Madam Web spat in my face, which I paid for that, too.
Oh, sorry. I was thinking of Madam Web, which somehow was worse than the Marvels.
Much worse. Much worse.
Yeah, Marvels is just kind of flat. It was. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
But then that last scene was like, all right, you hooked me back in. I'm coming. We all knew I'm coming back for Deadpool 3 anyway. Let's just get it over with.
No, I know. Look, they know me. They got me by the balls, and they know it.
Yep.
They got.
Speaking of violent superheroes, Deadpool series, yeah. Would you be interesting to see how it goes when it's, now that it's fully a Disney property, but.
Well, hey, Ryan Reynolds is here doing jokes about pegging in the first trailer to let you know Deadpool's not, he's not calming down for Marvel.
Yeah. We're keeping that early 2000s humor alive.
I can't say too many things about Ryan Reynolds. I'm in Vancouver right now, and his people are everywhere.
Oh, no. He might be looking in your window right now.
He may be the richest man in Vancouver and have a lot of influence there.
Could be. He could buy me out.
But as for me in Invincible, yes, I have my bona fides right here. This is the original Ultimate Collection of Invincible.
Well, nice.
I did not buy it issue 1 in 03, but I did start buying it in 04, or, well, 05 when this was published. And, yes, that is signed by Robert Kirkman on the front page there. So,
oh, nice.
That's how long I've been reading Invincible, though. It was pretty easy because Berkeley, California was where Image Comics, I think, still is officially like officed. And so because of that, Robert Kirkman came to town a number of times. It actually got kind of boring, like, oh, he's here again for a signing at the comic shop. I already got all the stuff I wanted signed. I don't need more. But yes, I was a big comic reader in 03, 04, and everybody was talking up Invincible, though I didn't read as much non-Marvel and DC super things then. And of course, by 04, Invincible was the second most popular Robert Kirkman book, or you know what, even the third, I'd say. Yep.
Oh, yeah, I couldn't believe how prolific he was. I didn't even know there was a third book, but this was running at the same time as what I mentioned previously, The Walking Dead. Walking Dead started in 2003, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, this published at the start of January of 03, and then Walking Dead is by October of 03. So, yeah, it's a very impressive. But he had the, as I watched in a lot of interviews, he's a prolific interviewer, by the way, too. But Kirkman talks about how, like, he started when he was very young. Like, he was 24 when the first issue published. And when you're that young and you start getting popular as a comic writer, you take every single job you can and you write 6 books a month if you can. Like, yeah.
Yep. Yep. And I can't blame him. Because who knows, you know, you don't know when that's going to end. So you do what you do when you can. And then I got depressed when I saw he was only 4 years older than me. I'm like, Oh, he's not some 60-year-old man who started when who had his big break in his 40s. Nope, he's the one you read about. Like, oh, look at this young guy who busted onto the scene in his early 20s, and he's still going.
I was shocked to see he wasn't even he's not even 50.
No, yeah, he's
nowhere
77,
close.
Baby, 78, 78.
Yeah.
No, it's, Kirkman became one of my favorite comic writers, but then I did get slightly tired of his, I dropped off Walking Dead after issue 100. I was like, I'm good. I had enough. And then, So I did read Invincible all the way through, but I more like popped in and out and, you know, in perfect vertical integration, thanks to the wonderful Amazon company, if you sign up for Kindle Unlimited, you can read all of Invincible included in your subscription. So if you want to catch up.
Oh, how nice.
Yeah,
I read Walking Dead up to a point, and then there was one issue that was just, wouldn't it be fun if an entire issue was just a man being tortured? And I thought, I can't read this anymore. and that was like just right before the TV series started, is now running in some form.
The original is over, but I think there's 3 spinoffs that are either currently on air or in production that are going to come out soon. I just can't believe that property has sustained itself that much.
It's incredible, yes, because there's, I believe it's Andrew Lincoln and Rick and Michonne. They're getting their own like movie or event series, and
I think it's like a mini series. I've seen the ads for it, and I'm like, oh, I didn't. That was the one I was not even aware of.
and the Death Stranding man's getting his own series, and but we're here to talk about Invincible and how I waited a long time for this show to finally get adapted, and as I was perusing the 20-year history of it to now, I was like, wow, that's how long. I was reminded of like being in my 20s and reading headlines of like, oh boy, there's going to be an Invincible movie soon when I was in my 20s.
Were these wizard rumors?
I had moved on to comicbookresources.com by this point.
Wow.
So, yeah. CBR.
That's like the New York Times of comic reporting.
And now every website's dead, so it's it doesn't.
Oh, I just saw the news about the Vice stuff yesterday, and it's like, wow.
No, it was awesome to try to research this and keep going to dead websites that were like for the news of this. Yeah,
you know, it's I'm not going to say it feels good, but it's it makes me feel better about my lost jobs, because it's not just tiny websites no one cares about that go away. The ones I worked on in the past, now every website's going away. So
yeah.
I've got a whole bunch of people in my same group here.
Video games were just on the vanguard of it.
We were the first to get laid off and shut down.
So Invincible's history. Let's dig into it here. Of course, you got to start with Robert Kirkman. He's the co-creator of the series alongside Corey Walker and also Ryan Ottley. That's the credit on the show, and I think that is accurate, though if you're going to go by how you credit creators of comics in comic book traditionally, it would just be Robert Kirkman and Corey Walker as the creator, but Ryan Ottley totally deserves to be a co-creator on the series. But so Robert Kirkman, born Kentucky, 1978. The background of an elder millennial with many similar tastes to all of us. He grew up reading all of these comic books, watching the G.I. Joe and Transformer shows, having all the toys, playing all the video games. As he grew up, he even became a fan of zombie movies. But when would that ever impact his later work? You know, never. but as the 90s wore on, he was starting to, you know, want to make his own comic books. And I do think a very important thing for him was when he was 14 was when Image Comics launched in 92. And that really showed a lot of people that you could do comic books that were edgier, bloodier, darker, still superhero, like hot, cool superhero stuff, but independently. And he really, really loved Image Comics, especially the Savage Dragon comic. He said that that was actually his favorite.
And we talked all about that, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, perhaps 4 or 5 years ago on this podcast.
Though I think that's a lie, honestly. Everybody's favorite was Spawn or X-Force or Wildcats. Nobody's favorite was Savage Dragon. Like,
hey, what about the Max? Who are the Max? I was one of the Max weirdos.
Right, yeah, or you're a Max weirdo, but... But that's the thing. I don't think Kirkman is goth enough. That's his thing to like, or depressed enough. Like,
there you go.
But yeah. So he even started doing his own indie comics in the late 90s, including one he jokes about that, like, oh, I'm not at all embarrassed about this comic. I'm very proud of it, called Battle Pope, where it's like, what if it's the post-apocalyptic future and the Pope is now a superhero and he fights people? Like,
I assume it's Pope John Paul. He was very popular. I could see him sustaining that comic.
Yes, yeah, and he co-created it with his pal Tony Moore, a friend and future lawsuit opponent.
Sorry,
defense.
Was he the first Walking Dead artist?
Yes, Tony Moore did the first half year of Walking Dead, then left the book, and then another guy took over, Charles Allard. And
yeah.
To cut to the future, Tony Moore felt that he got written out of the deal too early on Walking Dead by Kirkman and sued him. And it got a bit toxic. I think they settled out of court a couple times, actually, and Tony Moore got, I think he got his money.
That's good. I prefer his art, even though it was such a small portion of that comic. The other guy's art is fine, but my issue with his art was that all the characters kind of ended up looking too similar to each other, because I guess his style was like a little more realistic than the more cartoony Tony Moore, which I thought was a lot more fun.
Probably that guy's art being chunky and stuff also helps it publish on time, I would think.
Yeah,
too. Yeah.
Hey, you're making an Image comic. You don't need to put anything out on time.
Yeah, that's true. So, as Bob said, we've covered Savage Dragon before, so that's a good history on Image Comics. Short version is the top artists at Marvel were getting sick of being underpaid at Marvel for their huge success. They go independent and are selling huge books. It causes a comic boom, or helps increase a comic boom that then bursts very hard in the mid-90s, and by the late 90s, Image is in a very weird place where, like, Jim Lee is left, Rob Liefeld is left, Mark Silvestri is kind of left, and, like, Spawn is really the only dependable seller. The Savage Dragon from Eric Larson keeps going, too, and Eric Larson is, like, co-runner of the Image Comics company at this point. By the year 2000, Image is in this interesting place of chasing the new trend where, like, crime books and indie comics and black and white are getting a little more mainstream. So they're starting to publish some of that stuff, including with, like, Brian Michael Bendis. They're working a lot with him. He's starting to really take off. And so Savage Dragon's creator, Eric Larson, he meets a young man named Robert Kirkman, who is like, let me drive you to the Chicago Comic Con. Let me help you out. Like, he's really networking very well with Eric Larson. And so by 2001, Kirkman and Larson, Larson is liking Kirkman's work so much that Kirkman is working with his friend Corey Walker, also from Kentucky, who's like living in his house with it's Robert Kirkman, his new wife, and then Corey Walker on their couch. And they're trying to come up with a new comic. And their great idea for a comic is Science Dog.
Okay, that's the reference that starts off this episode.
Yes. Yeah. It's Science Dog is what if a regular dog got turned into a super scientist, and it's kind of comedic, but kind of a superhero thing. And they were really into Science Dog. That's why they plugged in appearances by Science Dog into issue one with their thought of like, well, this is the long-term plan. Our good buddy Science Dog, he's going to be big. But but Eric Larson, he liked Science Dog, but the other Image publishers didn't. And so they would not publish Science Dog. But Larson liked them so much that he then handed Kirkman and Walker a miniseries spinoff from Savage Dragon for the character Super Patriot, which is like, what if Captain America was a cyborg? That's Super Patriot. And Kirkman then takes on some work-for-hire gigs on some He-Man comics. He then comes up with like a teen Iron Man kind of idea called Tech Jacket, which eventually gets folded into the Invincible Universe. So if you want to say, what's the real start of the Invincible Universe? It's Tech Jacket. And he also does a thing called The Brit. But then in 2002... Eric Larson is looking for, and his co-publisher at Image, Jim Valentino, they're looking to launch a new line of colorful superhero books with an Image spin to it. So Kirkman and Walker come up with a new idea where it's going to be a young teen superhero book in a world full of heroes, but its own superhero world. And his dad is a Superman analog, but they have a surprising twist planned. That he's actually evil, and instead of being Superman from another planet, he's invading another planet, and he's trying to take it over. Now, a funny thing with that was they originally planned a long game of, like Kirkman says, yeah, and then we're going to do 2 whole years of the comic, and then in issue 25, we are going to shock readers by revealing it. And they held off until issue 6 in the original comic.
Yeah, I mean, this not knowing about the source material, this took me by surprise, the ending, the cliffhanger of this, the big shock. Mm. And I was wondering, you know, how many comics did you have to read before you really understood what the series was about?
Yeah, it was issue 7. It was after 6 issues. That's when they finally did it, but it was meant to shock you, and it was, I can tell you then, it was shocking. Cuz the first 6 issues are like, oh, this is kind of fun, you know. But then when that turn comes, you're like, oh, now that's when everybody was starting to tell people, you got to pick up Invincible. This comic is crazy.
Well, there's a big group of superheroes that you really don't have to worry about after a certain point, which was good for me because I couldn't keep all their names straight and their powers straight.
Oh, if you keep watching, Bob, don't worry. There's more.
Okay.
No, yeah, Invincible is like One Piece in that every issue there's like, here's 12 new characters.
Yeah. They don't all come back, but... In the next episode, their version of the Teen Titans, the Teen Team, is introduced, and they basically take the place of the ones that were no more at the end of this episode.
I mean, I know enough about superheroes that I understood most of the parodies. I was like, okay, there's your Aquaman joke.
Oh, yeah.
There's your the Flash. I almost called him the Speed, the Flash joke.
But yeah, so they put out the teaser for the book in August 2002, but it doesn't publish until January 2003. And a few issues in, Corey Walker, who designs everything, he is the real co-creator of it, he is having problems. He is not a monthly pace kind of artist. He really can't do monthly comics. And so the book's getting delayed. Sales are doing poorly. They're being told by the Image guys, like, if this doesn't pick up soon, you're about to finish. And they're like, oh, well, could we do the reveal of Omni-Man in issue 13? And they're like, you shouldn't assume you've got a 13. Like, you need to do this now.
Harsh truths.
But Kirkman says that's when they discovered an artist or got connected with an artist, a young guy who had never done regular monthly books before, Ryan Ottley, who they say saved the book because he could produce the issues very fast. He could be told, like, so there's 8 new superheroes in this one. He's like, got it. Just design the new character immediately. And so he stabilizes the book. They get out it monthly. Buzz starts to happen with the Omni-Man story. And it actually quickly goes up the charts. Of course, it was never as successful as the comic book, The Walking Dead, which would premiere at the end of 2003. But it did very well, probably also boosted by, did you know The Walking Dead guy has another comic that's also really violent? Yeah, I think it also helped, too, that this was the time when trade paperback collections of comics were really selling better in bookstores. Like, that had also gone really mainstream, thanks to Japanese comics getting much more mainstream in North America.
Yeah, like that's the phrase, like waiting for the trade was becoming very popular around the early aughts. I mean, they had always existed, but it felt like, well, the trade is inevitable for every series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know that's how I got into The Walking Dead. Was I got the first trade. I'm like, oh, okay. And then I started, waiting for them as best I could for the monthlies. My little local comic store is very small, didn't always have them for one reason or another. I think I just didn't order a lot, and it wasn't getting there quick enough, and they got sold out because it was so popular, at least in the first few years.
And Invincible started climbing up the charts so much that Kirkman was really getting noticed, and he started getting a lot more Marvel work, and this was normally the way things would go back then. If, like, this happened to Brian Michael Bendis, Ed Brubaker, and now Robert Kirkman, among others, who you have a successful indie book that starts getting better and better, and that's when Marvel and DC say, well, if you can do this, you can write Spider-Man, or you can write Daredevil, or you can write Batman, and then you become a full-time Marvel or DC guy, and that's your life. And that was the path he was on. Like, he starts writing Marvel Team-Up. He does a brilliant issue of Marvel Team-Up where he gets away with having Invincible cross over. Like, Marvel lets him have Invincible meet Spider-Man in an issue of Marvel Team-Up. That is canonical because in an issue 33 of Invincible, he goes through a portal to multiple portals and goes to multiple other universes, and he meets Spider-Man in the page, and then the Marvel Team-Up issue is that adventure as a Spider-Man in between pages in Invincible.
Okay, I was not expecting this, but I guess just to maintain relevance, there's way more crossovers than there ever used to be, correct?
Oh yeah. Well, especially in the comic world, you can tell when comics market is doing worse when more and more crossovers happen. And also a huge thing he does is he writes the series Marvel Zombies, which was a giant hit for Marvel, especially merchandising-wise, because they just made all of these zombie-style covers of classic covers from Marvel, but now their guts are spilling out on it. And those sold like nuts, T-shirts, posters, all this stuff.
I mean, I was kind of like into the zombie fad or wave or whatever. But when I saw that at the comic book store, I was like, oh, come now. Really?
Well, and it sold so well, but Robert Kirkman not getting his piece of the pie on that. He felt that he gives Marvel this giant, he was starting to feel just like how Todd McFarlane and Eric Larson felt. They gave Marvel Comics this huge hit, and he wasn't getting what he felt he should. So Invincible's plugging along. In 05 is the first time they get it optioned to be a movie. Paramount is interested in it, but like all those things, like it gets optioned, and then a few years later, the option runs out. And it's like, nah, we just didn't make a movie. And then Marvel Zombies is doing so well, and Kirkman's not feeling great about that. And then in 08, after being very frustrated with Marvel, he eventually becomes the first full partner in Image Comics since the original Seven Guys. He is elevated to partner in Image. He says he's only going to do creator-owned stuff at Image from now on, and he quits Marvel work and doesn't do any DC work. And I believe he has stayed true to that. I don't think he has done any non-creator-owned work since 2008. And he also wanted to bring over a ton of people to it. He helped exacerbate this thing that happened too, of like a lot of top writers in Marvel, especially NDC, were doing the backwards thing of like they would publish a popular thing like Ed Brubaker, co-creator of the Winter Soldier storyline in Captain America. He then uses that to start making his own comics at Image that he gets 100% of the profits on instead of the other way around. Though Brubaker especially is a heartbreaking guy. He's been one of the most public of saying, I created or co-created Winter Soldier. I made more money on my SAG payments for being a cameo in the Winter Soldier movie than I did on licensing the character. So Invincible continues on a 15-year run all the way up to 2018. But in that same time, Kirkman gets huge, huge, huge because Walking Dead is a popular comic. Then in 2010, it becomes an AMC series. And I remember being there night one for the debut because I was like, wow. And then I had that feeling I had, the same I had with Rick and Morty and lots of other shows, where I realized, like, this is now popular enough as to not be niche for me anymore, and I feel not included anymore.
My experience with that was, I think a lot of people had a similar experience, where pilot of that Walking Dead series is really, really good. You hit the mm-hmm. second episode, and it really lets you know, well, this is what the series is actually going to be like. And that's when I was like, okay, that's enough.
Yeah.
I watched a really good hour-long zombie movie by Frank Darabont, and that's enough mm-hmm. for me.
I pretty much stopped by the – I stuck around till the debut of the second season. And then I was like, this is what it is. Hey, I'm good. I'll just read the mm-hmm. comics.
Oh, I stuck along. I went through season, I guess, 3. I made it to the prison storyline
yeah.
that was adapted, and that's when I – dropped off. I'm like, all right, no thanks.
I mean, I think, like, because Henry and I were in the games industry at this time, we had a lot of self-punishing peers who would not give up on The Walking Dead. Mm-hmm. The same people I think who loved Lost were like, no, it will recover.
Yep.
It's just a little slow in plotting. It's still good. It's still good.
Yeah. They know where they're going. Yeah.
Hey, they were having fun. It's fine. But
well, and also, Bob, is when me and you worked at a certain website together, Walking Dead was like half of their views, and so yes. everything was just like, so what's your Walking Dead pitch this week? And we're like, can we talk about something that isn't Walking Dead?
That game in Game of Thrones, I think, were
yep.
hot.
Hot.
Yep.
Yeah. But the show became huge. I was there for like the first – I went to the first San Diego Comic-Con after the show and like got to meet Steven Yeun on a walk and talk interview thing, and him saying like he's a big time movie star who's starring in like serious stuff, Oscar nominated things, but back then he was like a relatively new actor, and he's like, wow, this is crazy, like that kind of thing. Also, Walking Dead gets a big boost from the video game in 2011 as well, like that the Telltale game surprise hit. And this is when Kirkman, he is a smart businessman on top of being a creative powerhouse, because he realizes, I need to not license these things where I have no control over. And instead, he creates his own imprint company at Image called Skybound, which basically controls all of the stuff that is made. Like this, Invincible, the TV show, is a Skybound TV show. It's not like it's Prime puts it on, but Skybound is the production company of it.
Oh, so that's what that is. Okay.
Okay.
And also, as he learned from working on Walking Dead 1, it's really hard to adapt a show as your comic is continuing to be published. And so it really helps that, say, with Invincible later, the comic's over, so they can pick and choose what they're going to do instead of changing it as they go. And also, yes, it's where he met Steven Yeun, who he is good friends with, and he would maybe cast him in things in the future. But the joke always was, Kirkman said, every time for years of promoting the Walking Dead TV show, he was asked almost every interview, when's Invincible? When's Invincible? When's Invincible? I think that's also why the name of this episode is It's About Time. Because
yeah. You know, I like this approach, though, because it's something that we talked about manga and stuff earlier in this program. It's something that Japan had done for a while, where they wait until there's like a lot of comic and then they just literally adapt the comic.
Mm-hmm.
When I feel like we've covered things where it's like, oh, this Batman the Animated Series is loosely adapting this comic, or this X-Men cartoon is loosely adapting this comic. Here it's just like, oh, we're animating the manga that came before. And it was all mm-hmm. done by the time the show premiered, which is great. They didn't have to invent any. There's no filler arc in Invincible.
Yeah. No, really, Invincible is much more of a Japanese publishing model of a creator and an artist, or a writer and an artist, do a whole series, and you read that whole series. Now, there are side books in the world if you want to read those too. There's spinoffs and stuff, but if you just want to read Invincible from beginning to end, that's 144 issues. But so, when was Invincible going to be adapted? Well, it started rolling a little better in 2017, which was an interesting year for Kirkman, because he's starting to wind down his comic work, because television pays a lot better. Even independent comics, where you get most of the profit, TV pays better. So first in April of 2017, it is announced that Seth Rogen and his good chum Evan Goldberg, their production company, has licensed it to be a live-action film, and with the idea that Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg are going to direct it. Seth Rogen, let me just say, he, of all the Hollywood comedy douches who come in and take over comic books and make them, he is the best because I really like The Boys. He is somewhat involved in this too. And his Ninja Turtles cartoon last year was All Mutant Mayhem, also really good.
Yeah, again, I can't say too much because I am in Vancouver, but I have grown to like Seth Rogen. I never disliked him, but I thought, boy, he's just attached to everything.
And so that's licensed for a movie. Then in late August, Robert Kirkman, who had already sued the channel AMC for unpaid profits for a long time and has not liked working on The Walking Dead with them, he says he is done with AMC. He's not making anything new for them because he just signed a huge money deal with Amazon to produce original content for the relatively new Prime Video streaming service that Amazon has, which was basically like, well, if you like free shipping, do you also want to watch TV shows?
They won't have ads for a while.
For a while.
It took a few years, but yeah. It is
nuts that Amazon just decided, like, well, I guess we should make our own TV shows too, shouldn't we? Shouldn't we also just have a Netflix?
And let's make the service worse because everyone else is making their services worse.
It's allowed us to be worse and force ads on people. It's just... 40 years ago, I remember this, there was a SCTV sketch that made no sense to me when I watched it in the 90s. My parents had to explain it, where the sketch is a character is cruelly explaining to viewers, like, cable TV has commercials now, get used to it. And I was like, wait, there were no commercials on any cable channels? And my mom was like, yeah, that is how it used to be. That's now with streaming services. When Amazon licensed it, though, the original reporting on it in 2017 was like, well, but Invincible can't be part of that because that was already part of Universal's deal, so there won't be an Invincible show. Then a year later, it's announced, no, there will be an Invincible show, and Amazon Studios will produce it with Skybound. This actually is not, though, Kirkman's first animated series because, speaking of Canada, Robert Kirkman really likes doing business in Canada because he did a show called Super Dinosaur, a kid show that aired first in Canada and then on Prime Video. And most of his productions are done in Canada, specifically Vancouver.
Hey, you know, I recommend being here. And turns out the show is made. I can just walk there after this podcast if I wanted to.
You can stalk them and check out what's happening in season 3. And so, yes, Rogan and Goldberg would be producers on the show, too, but not major producers. More like, honestly, I think it's more of an honorarium than anything else. But not only that, but they also make the gutsy move that they decide that this would be virtually unheard of in TV animation. It will be an hour-long format, which obviously in TV terms means 45 to 55 minutes. It kind of fluctuates. But there's a reason animation doesn't do an hour-long format, because it takes a long time and it's much more expensive. But I do like how the pacing of this is not true. It is a real hour-long. It's not two episodes stitched together. Like, they include, from the first episode, they make it clear of like, hey, this will have weird pacing you're not used to in animation.
Yeah, I like it. I mean, it's very rare. I'm sure there are other things like this, but like the Pluto miniseries, also adapting a comic, those are all also hour-long episodes.
So Kirkman says that it's going to be great because they can work from the skeleton of the story they've already finished, or because he's ending the series right as they sign these deals. And it's incredible, though, that it took that long. And then 7 months later, they announced the cast, which we'll get to later. It's an incredible cast. And they're like, oh, and it's going to be... You know, it's going to debut in 2020, they say. And what possible thing could happen to delay the release of something in 2020? You know, nothing. Nothing could.
I dare it to stop this, whatever unknown force.
So, yes, they cast the show. It's an amazing cast. It's all the people I would cast for things who I'm like, oh, yeah, these are all amazing actors, especially, though, the two leads. You got Steven Yeun as Mark Grayson. You got... Omni-Man is played by J.K. Simmons, the Oscar-winning actor, one of my favorite guys. And you've got Sandra Oh as the mother, Debbie Grayson, who is written a lot better than she was in the original series, or at least at the start of the original series. And Kirkman credits a lot of the great casting to casting director Linda Lamontagne. Also interesting is he has a co-showrunner on the show, an EP named Simon Rasiopa, who, when I looked at his stuff, like, he worked on Teen Titans, but then mostly other, like, real kid stuff. His first actual, like, adult cartoon was he wrote an episode of the animated The Boys spinoff. And I don't want to say that it's a Canadian government requirement that the co-showrunner has to be a Canadian citizen, but that is what Simon is, and he is a Canadian citizen who's co-showrunner of the show.
I say maybe it helps.
Mm-hmm. It might grease the wheels a little. Supervising directors of season one are also really, very interesting because it's announced that the supervising directors are going to be Justin and Chris Copeland, who look into their stuff. They are really impressive guys, a pair of brothers, top black talents in animation. I watched several interviews with them. They're very interesting guys. They worked on Young Justice, Spider-Man, Batman. That's why this show looks like all those shows or those movies. Mm. Like they kept hiring guys who worked on those things that adult animate action superhero stuff like that. I don't think there was any bad blood on it, but basically in mid-2019, they get a deal to do a feature film at DreamWorks, the Copeland brothers, to direct it themselves, and they exit the series. They're supervising director on the first two episodes, though not in credit. Though if you go to their LinkedIn, they write supervising director. So, but the Copeland brothers, I'm very interested to see what else they're going to do. They did some great boards for this episode, too. But instead, the supervising director is Jeff Allen, another guy who did like 100 episodes of shows that look like this, including the Disney Marvel show Avengers Assemble. Like, so again, this is why they all look like this. Hmm. It also helped, though, that Skybound created Skybound North, based out of Vancouver, where they would have most of the animation talent on this side of the Pacific.
Located in near Chinatown, where I go often to get ramen and other delicious treats.
It's Skybound North is also very interesting because this was, Andrew, a very cool thing I found out. So the head of the company is a woman named Catherine Winders, or Winders. I don't know how it's pronounced, but she worked on the Angry Birds movie. She was an executive at Lucasfilm Animation on the CG Clone Wars. And before that, in the 90s, she worked on early adult animation like Aeon Flux, Spawn, the truly horrid Spicy City show.
Ooh.
And before that, she was the executive producer in charge of production at Hanna-Barbera for SWAT Cats.
Whoa. Huh. It all comes back to SWAT Cats.
Look at that. The linchpin.
She even had interesting stories. I'd love to interview her just about how she also worked on Disney Afternoon stuff and basically like lived in Korea and Japan for several years just being the on-site coordinator with the U.S. Teams for overseas production. Like that sounds really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Skybound North works with a company called Wind Sun Sky, which is a Seoul, Korea-based company, as well as NE4U. And they also both animate on things just like this, including the Harley Quinn show, the Invader Zim movie, all this stuff. So it's a lot of the same people working on it. So just as before, boarding layout done in Vancouver, then sent over to Korea who do the full animation on it. Thanks, though, to the pandemic and lockdown, production really slows down. They write all the scripts in 2019, record with all the people in 2019, and it takes 2 years to finish the first season, which would be 8 episodes long. But they finally finish it. It debuts March 26, 2021. And it's at the end of April where this is another problem with the streaming age. Amazon waits until they really see it's a success, and they renew it then at the end of April 2021. They're like, all right, we're renewing for seasons 2 and 3. And as Kirkman would say in interviews, basically, they shut down production after season one and had to rehire everybody. He says, like, we shut down the factory and now have to reopen the factory and restaff it. And that's why it takes 30 months for the second season to come out.
Yeah, we've seen it before with all these animated shows on the bubble where the renewal comes and then you're waiting 18 months to see anything else.
That's why, like, you know, the production model of once, like say Disney or Warner like something in the 90s, they're like, yeah, it sounds like a good idea. 65 right now, like Batman, just do, if we're doing this, do 65. It's either 0 or 65. But it does seem like the machine is actually moving now, and it won't take more than 2 years for season 3 to come out. And also, I kind of like that they staggered it of like four episodes and four episodes of season four, though some people did not.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's got its ups and advantages and disadvantages, so I didn't mind it because it gave me a chance to, you know, watch some other things that was in my backlog, so.
I know we shouldn't highlight the worst fans of something, but people mad about the shortage of episodes. Like, don't you have there are so many things to watch. Shut up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Don't you have enough? I feel overwhelmed. And I watch things for a living. Just watch something else, and then in time you'll get the next four. It's crazy that people are mad about this.
Like, oh, thank God it's done in four episodes. Phew.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, and also Corey Walker was the lead character designer for the series too. So that's kind of a rarity in comics where the original comic artist is the lead character designer on your animated series. But and also like. Ryan Ottley gets to go to creator status even though he didn't create the series because he is as responsible for the success of the series as anybody. So good for him. And these are the rare times where a comic artist can pick. If you see Kirkman, Ottley, or Corey Walker do produce a comic book now, you know they give a shit about it because they're not doing it to pay the rent. Like, it's because they like it. And yeah, now it's at an interesting time where Seth Rogen even says the series is so popular that it's actually changing how they're developing that live-action film that still doesn't have like a director or a cast or anything. But Rogen in some interview indicated that like we were having trouble convincing him to do certain things with his show or with the movie. But now that the show is so popular, we actually get to make it more like the comic. Though, yeah, if you read the comic and watch the show, it is the comic come to life. Though they made a few changes. They woke-ified it. in Wade
Woke Dog's mob.
Yeah, but yeah, no, and Rogan's even a voice in the show, too. But so currently season three has been written. Kirkman tells a funny story I found in one time where an actor on the show was like, who did a voice in season two? Said, well, I hope the show gets picked up. This seems like a good show. And then he's like, tomorrow you're coming in to record for season three, so we're doing good. We're doing good. But yeah, now the series is so big, it almost feels redundant to do a live action. I'm glad they did it as animation instead of live action because budget-wise, on The Boys, you can see them smashing against the budget, and this has way more super stuff in it than The Boys does. And I think it maybe actually is change the opinion of some people about what prestige you could actually have a prestige animated hour-long show maybe like I hope it's changed the minds.
Yeah, I mean I don't know who is not going to watch this that would watch the live action one, but a live action one would seem just superfluous at this point just because this has been executed on so well. But I guess it's just, hey, that's more money in the money pool. Yeah. So let's make that too.
Absolutely. Yeah. And sadly, there are lots of people who like, still, in America anyway, are like, well, but that's cartoon. I don't watch cartoons. Like, they will still say that. But yeah, I guess, so that's the history of how the series was created. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we will go through the cast, all the stuff, the director, the writer of the first episode of Invincible. It's about time.
But how about you? What have you been up to? It's been a while. I think everyone agrees it's been, like, a little ridiculous how long it's been.
Hey, I've been busy.
Doing what?
Well, I've been busy writing, designing, storyboarding, voice acting, key posing, in-betweening, cleaning up, color slapping, comping the whole thing and all that for, you know, roughly thousands of shots. So it's kind of a lot.
Sure, yeah. Although, like, 90% of that, if I'm being honest, sounds completely made up. But the real question is, when are you going back out there? The world needs more Invincible.
Oh, it's coming, okay? Hey!
Yeah, I know, but, like, a specific date would be nice.
Oh, okay, fine. The world will get more Invincible in late 2023.
All right, okay, I'll take it. Late 2023. Perfect, sure. So 2023, is that like one of your years? You know, our planets, they all have different systems of keeping track of time. Like, they go around their stars at different speeds, but the way you said that number, makes it sound soon. Is it soon? I really want it to be soon.
Right, and we are back to talk about the first episode of Invincible, the song taking you in, because the show does not have an opening or closing theme, really. I instead chose the major song from this episode, Cage the Elephant, song from the episode.
Well, I think they know, well, this is streaming. You're going to hit the skip button anyways.
It's so the opposite as me starting to watch One Piece regularly now, where 2 minutes is opening in every episode, and then usually a 30-second recap on top of that.
30 if you're lucky. More, it's usually like a 2-minute recap.
I mean, the animation is so good in One Piece that, no, I wouldn't complain, but it's not a bad scam that they're like, some weeks they get away with 12 minutes of new footage on a 25-minute show.
I think on the whole, I mean, because I'm now up to like episode 400 on One Piece, watching it for a very long time, slowly. And I think, honestly, it is a 15-minute show.
Yeah. No, I this current arc in the of episodes are still that way, though the animation is really good.
You say it's a good-looking show. It's a good-looking show now.
Yes.
It took about 20 years for it to be a good-looking show. It was an adequate-looking weekly show for a very long time. But now I see the clips, and it's like, oh, they're actually like given more money or given more resources or allowed to like do the Sakuga scenes that are turning people's heads.
Not to make this about One Piece for a minute, I also think that they have like producers now who know internationally there's so many One Piece fans who will just draw something cool for them. Like they get more freelance people for like American, European artists who will draw cool things freelance because they love One Piece that much, including our pal Ian Jones-Cordy is one of those types of people.
Very cool, yeah.
But yeah, so Invincible, I did want to go over the cast real quick, or the rest of it, who are really great. Again, it's Gillian Jacobs as Adam Eve. She rules. Like, she's not, though, in this episode. You got Zazie Beetz as Amber. You got Andrew, who is on Atlanta. She's great on Atlanta. And Andrew Rannells, the Book of Mormon guy, he plays William. Then Walton Goggins, another of my favorite character actors, he's in it. Yeah, Jason Mantzoukas, who is comedy podcast superstar and an actual real mega fan of Invincible. So he was very
excited. Oh, really?
The show.
Oh, cool.
Didn't know that.
And also great character actors like Clancy Brown. And you got Oscar winner Mahershala Ali in here. Mark Hamill. And even though it is, this sounds like I'm saying they are not as good, but I like that they fill in that spackle of great actors with also the great voiceover regulars like, say, Gray Griffin and Kevin Michael Richardson. It's a very strong list.
And, I'll mention it when we get there, but there was another actor who kind of snuck in as a little cameo, it looked like, because it's not a very big role, but it's a big actor, so.
Well, yes, it's very weird that, like, the second person to speak on the show is Jon Hamm. That is very,
yeah.
That was unexpected.
Oh yeah, yeah. I saw him in the credits. I was like, "What? Huh?"
Yeah, he's the white security guard at the White House. So
oh,
he's
wow.
got
okay.
you know a few lines of dialogue there, and then I think he has a little bit in the second episode, and then I don't know if he comes back in the rest of the season. I can't remember off the top of my head. I watched the first episode a few times for this one. I didn't finish their whole first season again. I did go through it all a few months ago, but in prep for the second season. But I didn't finish the whole season again.
I forgot the great bit that in the start of episode 2, they have like a mirror of the opening scene of this one, mm-hmm. of John Hamm and his son are on their trip to London, and then the garbage bag that Mark throws in this episode
yep.
crashes into them. It's a very funny open.
And it's great because the entire time, both this episode and then especially the beginning of the next one, you think this guy's done for. It,
mm-hmm.
It's the perfect tragic backstory of the cop or the security guard who's like, oh, once we're done, I'm going to go do this fun thing with my family.
I know.
Yeah, I was glad they avoided that because it could have easily been a setup for an overdone joke at this point. But I was happy to see that he survived. And one thing about this series, I was worried. I know Kirkman, he's got like a Gen X-y sense of humor. I know he's like on the borderline kind of, but that's why I associate with him. So I was worried that the violence in this series is going to be like what you see in Harley Quinn, where it's kind of glib about the murders and the violence on the screen. But when there's violence in this, it like really matters,
yeah.
at least in what I've seen of it mm-hmm. so far. So when this guy was not immediately like turned into goo, I thought, okay, this show, I have faith in this show now.
Yeah, it is interesting comparison point to, you know, Harley Quinn, which is its contemporary in current animation. And then you've got Venture Brothers, which they debuted around the same time, and they're both pulling from similar stuff. But Venture Brothers and then Harley Quinn, which is very influenced by Venture Brothers, both of those shows are like, this is a comedy about comic books. And so death is still a joke. Like Venture Brothers sometimes mm-hmm. will be like, no, you should care this time. Like, this actually is important. But most of the time, it's like, this is a joke. But in Invincible, it is a dramatic comic book story with jokes. So when the drama happens or violence happens, it matters. And that's a key difference. But and also like, yes, Kirkman loves violence. He also loves subverting expectations. He wrote the comic and then he writes this episode with the expectation of, he said this out, he wrote the comic with everybody who's reading this has read a million superhero comics. So when they expect something happens in a normal superhero comic, I'm going to do the opposite. And now he said that he has the benefit of Marvel movies especially have made superhero comic cliches and tropes more mainstream than ever. So he can still play off of that in the show in new ways. So this episode was written by Robert Kirkman. He wrote the pilot and he wrote the finale of the first season as well. The director of the first episode is also a really interesting guy, Robert Valley, who, when I looked into his stuff, I was like, oh, this guy's cool as hell. So his background is he's an American, though he also has been a Vancouver resident for years.
It's a good place to be. By the way, everybody, I'm in Vancouver. Did you know that?
this is
I don't think I mentioned it yet.
This is such a Vancouver. If only Andrew was in Seoul, Korea, then it'd be all three quadrants of this. So Robert Valley is an Oscar-nominated animation director. He directed the 2016 Oscar-nominated short Pear, Cider, and Cigarettes. And when you look at his original art, he's done a lot of design work, commercial work, and an animation work. He was a key character designer and animator on the first string of Gorillaz music videos, which are great, great looking music videos. He also worked on previous What a Cartoon subject, X-Men Evolution.
Oh, okay.
Thanks.
So a great pick to direct your pilot episode of the show. Though also just as important is the overseas animation director, Hae-Yong Jung, or Hae-Yong Jung. I need to get better at pronouncing Korean names if we're talking about animation, and I apologize for this. But Jung had worked on a lot of American projects, North American projects. He did the Netflix Voltron show, a ton of Marvel and DC stuff, also Avatar The Last Airbender and Korra. So quite a pedigree, making him perfect for Invincible.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Oh, and by the way, as much as I'm praising that I think the Prime Video app has, I really like its X-ray feature because many times I'm like, wait, mm-hmm. who's that voice? Pause, and then it just tells me the voice. And it gives you some fun trivia here and there. But the jeers to the Prime Video app is how commercials are back. And mm-hmm. like this had three goddamn commercials on it.
Oh.
And then they tell you don't want commercials. Give us $3 more a month on top of the $170
oh,
a
God,
year
right?
you pay for Prime.
I mean, everybody pirates stuff, so it's not special in any way. But
yeah.
I love when I pirate things that I have access to that I paid money for, where it's like it's actually easier for me to just jump on a torrent and have everything in about 10 minutes than for me to wait through, you know, your original programming ads and mm-hmm. then get more ads served to me on top of that and have a crappy interface when VLC is just right there waiting for me.
So this episode is a sort of, I would say it is a 70% accurate recreation of the first 6-7 issues of the comic, but it compresses things, it changes up characters, and from the beginning it changes up things because this first scene is not in the comic, but it is a very important scene because now if you're a comic reader and you read the first 6 issues and you just hear people mention the Guardians of the Globe, you instantly know these are the Avengers or the Justice League of this world. And then when you mm-hmm. see them on the page, you're like, oh, it's the Justice League. That's Wonder Woman. That's Aquaman. That's the Flash. They all have one-to-one comparisons. But if you're just jumping into this world, you need a big action scene of the Guardians of the Globe to know what their deal is.
Yeah, and you can't start a comic this way because this set piece would take an entire comic to, you know, portray. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't even get to the main characters yet. I mean, maybe you can get to him waking up in bed in the last few pages. But that's about it.
and so, we start with zoom in on the White House. And, yes, we have John Hamm, and the other security guard is voiced by Sean Patrick Thomas, who does a good deal of voice acting work. He'd be most famous to younger millennials or Zoomers because he is the male lead alongside Julia Stiles in Save the Last Dance.
Mm.
And also he's one of the younger guys in the Barbershop series. And also, I believe, the only black man who is in Cruel Intentions, I think. So, he's in a lot of aughts classics. But they're funny together. You hear a stepdad. Basically, you hear about how he's the dad who stepped up, John Hamm's character. But I think it's a good tone setter, too, because, like, this, if Invincible is anything, it's a show about a father and son. So you start with a father and son story here at the White House with the security guard. Though it does feel weird to hear John Hamm do a delivery of, like, sucks to be you. that's a little odd. But as these two guys are talking about, you know, coffee and a son struggling with drug abuse and overcoming it and all that stuff, and then also saying, like, what is it to be a security guard in a world of super beings?
Mm-hmm.
Then, kaboom, we get our first supervillains of the show, the recurring villains of a lot of Invincible, the Mahler twins, who I really like their game, and their voice both by Kevin Michael Richardson's, but their concept is, they are a super scientist cloned himself and can never be sure who is the clone and who's the original, and they always argue about it.
I wasn't quite sure what the concept was, but I like how the bickering is nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're kind of like if Lex Luthor was combined with, like, Solomon Grundy or something, or I guess just the Hulk, just both smart and strong. And I guess, light spoilers, you do see them come back later. And it kind of explains the whole cloning thing. Like, part of the cloning is that he briefly erases his memory.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't remember which side of the cloning pod he got in. So that's why it ensures he never knows which one's the clone, which is the original. So that way they're both on equal footing and one doesn't try and, I guess, be superior to the other and boss them around too much. But it doesn't work because they both boss each other around.
Yeah, I like their bickering. Also, note that when the fight starts, one of them gets shot in the eye. That is helpful for the viewer to know which one is which, and you can keep track in the fight.
That's also one of those superhero speculation things where, you know, if Superman is invincible, can I still shoot him in the eye? What would happen? I feel like they're answering questions up front.
Yep.
No, this is something I loved about Kirkman's work from the start and what really drew me to him, especially Invincible and Walking Dead, because they are very, like, grounded and rules-oriented, or just of, like, in this world you would say, well, okay, wait a minute. If this guy, say, makes his own body to put his robot brain into, how do you literally do that? Or if there's another hero later introduced who's like, she is an adult woman, but her superhero curse is that every time she uses her superpower, she de-ages. So she looks like a 12-year-old, but is like 24, and that is an uncomfortable world for her to live in. And so it's just all these questions of like, well, what's it like to really be that? Or even just in this episode, how people discuss, well, how do you physically fly? Like, how do you think I want to fly? Like, I just love all that stuff. But yeah, they're fighting at the White House. There's also this funny thing of like, it happens twice in this episode where you think, okay, if you're just a regular guy who's a security guard with a gun, just leave, like just run. Like you're going to turn into red paste in like a second.
It feels like modern security guards, I think the like the independent ones, they're just kind of paid to call the police. And I mean, yeah. And like fundamentally, they're paid to be the ones who are probably hurt first before clerks or managers or anyone like that.
Though, of course, these guys are Secret Service, so they are supposed to be the best of the best. So I get why they didn't run. But and so the Mahler brothers, though, are then stopped from invading the White House because the Guardians of the Globe show up, which you can look up all their names. But the joke is, they are all cast members of The Walking Dead. That's the inside joke.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't understand that.
So it's a cute little joke of like, oh, yeah, you guys know The Walking Dead. Well, here they are. And you might think these guys are going to be around forever. But no. And so, yeah, you got Darkwing, who's Batman. You got War Woman, who's Wonder Woman. You've got Martian Man, who's Martian Manhunter.
Yes. Now, I got that one at least.
That one's a little, they could have gone a little more clever with that, I guess. But sometimes it's kind of nice that it's so on the point of just, yeah, Martian Man, why not?
but yes, let's hear. I actually am slightly light on clips compared to, you would think, for a 40-minute show, but that's because it's a lot of just grunting and long fight scenes, which all look great. I'm not saying it's bad, but yes, here's our first clip of the Guardians of the Globe arriving.
We can take it from here. Fall back. Help us evacuate civilians.
Yes, ma'am.
War Woman. Please, you couldn't just sit this one out. Let us kill the president, and you earned a day off.
Not our style. Sorry.
This is an spectator sport. Move!
There's just some great action of them saving everybody, but also the groundedness comes in early, too, because when Red Rush, the Flash, speeds away everybody super fast, they all get motion sickness.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I love stuff like this, again, which was the second Watchmen wave, which is like, let's think more realistically about how these powers affect themselves and the people around them.
Yeah, Bob, you might actually, when you were first watching it, and you're like, so is this like Harley Quinn or Venture Brothers? The scene of the Red Rush getting like a domino effect of everybody vomiting at once, like that is like a Venture Brothers scene.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But also there's some great they're showing off their fight choreography early here too, because like the Immortal starts punching, like they're actually having a really good, like almost like boxing match between him and one of the Maulers. And they're saving everybody. And then you also see that the Batman equivalent Darkwing barely can keep up with the rest of the team. He's just throwing exploding batarangs everywhere. He's
almost like Batman combined with, from Marvel, I guess like Night Thrasher. Because
he's got the
flying skateboard.
Yes, yeah, he's a little more intense too.
Yeah.
He's got all the bombs too.
Yeah,
correct?
Yeah.
And he's less afraid of using the bombs on the bad guys than Batman would be, for instance. Although Batman, I guess, would if it's a big tough guy. But you know, we see later, you know, a little bit. Darkwing is a little bit more violent than Batman, which fits with this world, obviously.
Yeah, it's also fun. This is cutting to the later, but when you see Darkwing in his Gotham City, it's nighttime there, and you just think, yeah, it's Gotham City. It's night. It's equivalent. Of course, it's at night. But you later find out that the city got cursed by a magician to always be night. It's always night in his city.
That's great.
But yeah, the fight keeps going a little south for the Guardians of the Globe. They're having trouble saving people at the same time. You get to see the Green Ghost, which is. It's more like the Vision in Powers, but stylistically and the way it's activated, it is like the Green Lantern.
Yeah, yeah. And also, it's almost, in a way, they almost sort of split Martian Manhunter powers in 2 because the shape-shifting Martian Manhunter powers went to Martian Man. And then the intangibility part of it went to Green Ghost. But again, it's also like Vision can be intangible. Kitty Pratt can also be intangible from Marvel Comics. So it's not like Martian Manhunter is the only one who has that power. So.
And Darkwing gets trapped under a tank, is about to be crushed to death. And Omni-Man then shows up. Omni-Man's here. But you get to see there's already a little tension here. Like, these guys aren't all friends. Darkwing says nothing to Omni-Man and then runs away. And Omni-Man's like, you're welcome. Like, you get a little bit of the Omni-Man definitely feels superior to the rest of the team.
Mm-hmm.
Just as Superman should with the rest of the Justice League. Like, Sean Baby on his old website when he made fun of Super Friends, he mentioned, like, Superman can do everything any member of the Justice League can do and doesn't need them.
Mm-hmm.
but though it helps that Omni-Man does not have, like, all the... He's Superman except no laser vision or cold breath or X-ray vision, so he's just a very, very strong guy.
He's like a really, really big man.
So... Omni-Man is saving everybody, and he's kind of doing cleanup. And you also can see when the Immortal is fighting, he has this cool bit of throwing those people in the air to buy him time while he's punching. And then Omni-Man saves 4 of the 5 guys, and the Immortal thinks he needs to save the 5th guy, but Omni-Man's like, I got him. Like, you can see Immortal and Omni-Man don't see eye to eye exactly.
Yep. Hmm. And one thing I noticed was clever about the Immortal is, from what I can tell, he can't fly.
Yes, he's a jumper.
He actually literally has to just leap really strong, like Hulk or sort of OG Superman, I guess, back when they said he can jump really high but can't fully fly.
Yeah. It's this, again, if you're a superhero dork, you know that, like, oh, guys who leap feel inferior to a flying guy.
And Superman was just a jumper for a long time, right?
Yes.
We covered that in our Superman Fleischer shorts.
That's why he can leap tall buildings in a single bound. But yeah, the fight, they all recover, and then we even get a big hero shot, like basically like a big splash page on the like you'd see in a comic of the whole team. Mm-hmm. And just as you think the fight's about to really get to its apex, an explosion covers the screen, and then we see transition to the back of a comic book. That has an explosion on it, and we go to that to seeing our hero of the show sitting on the toilet reading a comic book, just like you, the viewer. You read comics on the toilet too.
I am personally attacked.
They're going to only depreciate if you do that.
and this is how you first see Mark chronologically in the comic too. Like, this is his same introduction here, reading on the toilet. Though here is one of the first big changes in the show to the comic. Science Dog becomes Seance Dog.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, because when you mentioned Science Dog, I thought of the reference, but then I thought they spelled it incorrectly, or they couldn't actually represent the name of it.
So Kirkman's very upfront about why this happened, and Seance Dog is like a Doctor Strange. I mean, he is Doctor Strange, but a dog. Yeah, that's what it is. But it was because Corey Walker and Robert Kirkman own Science Dog, but if they put Science Dog in an Amazon show, then Amazon has licensed the rights to Science Dog, and if they ever wanted to make a Science Dog show of their own, they already gave it to Amazon. So instead they're like, let's just make him Seance Dog and save Science Dog for our own thing.
I think they're going to adapt Battle Pope first.
The super dinosaur happened, so it's Battle Pope next.
There we go. Battle Pope or Young Pope, who will come out on top?
I want to see that. Well, I mean, once that second Lord of the Rings season comes out and no one talks about it again, maybe they could just spread that money around.
When do they give up on it? Well, because also, you know, the stories behind the scenes are that, like, the evil Lex Luthor of Amazon loves Lord of the Rings, and it's like his personal project.
Mm. You know, that $3 they're charging you to not watch ads, that's your Lord of the Rings tax, basically.
Look, they spent all that money getting all the material that isn't actually the Lord of the Rings books.
Nope.
Or the Hobbit books, I think. Hobbit books.
No, it's the
everything else.
It's the appendices of the Lord of the Rings. That's what it is. And, I watched the first episode and thought, it's fine, but, like...
Yeah, I think I made it 2. I'm just like, maybe if I have to the point made earlier, it's like there's so many other things I could be watching that I am more inclined and want to watch. I'm not going to watch this out of obligation. I don't have that much time.
But yeah, so another change from the comic is when you see Mark on the toilet in the comic, it's just a one-page thing, and his mom respects his privacy. Here, I kind of like that Debbie is just like, look, I don't care. I changed your diapers. I need to. She's the type of mom who's like, I need to grab new towels. But yes, this is when we meet Mark on the toilet and we see what Omni-Man's like at home.
Mom, what? I'll be out in a minute.
I don't have a minute.
Mom!
My bathroom's out of soap. Get over yourself. I used to change your diapers, kid. There's nothing going on down there I haven't seen before.
Just get out!
As you can see, the scene is absolute chaos as the Mahler twins...
Looks like Dad's saving the White House.
Alone?
Guardians are there, too.
Who are they fighting? Oh, Mahler twins. Looks like we won't be getting breakfast together this morning. Summer.
It's the White House, Mom. Kinda important.
Oh, they rebuild that thing twice a year at this point. If it's not Doc Seismic, it's the Lizard League or someone else. I doubt the president still lives there.
I'm not too late. I'm going to shower.
Not so fast. Come here first.
Don't make me get the spray bottle.
Horny parents. Disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
that's another bit I just love, that like they point out that if you lived in a world where superheroes fight all of the time, the White House likely explodes twice a year and has to be rebuilt every year. And I love her point too, like, why would the president even live there?
Yeah.
Like, you're just asking to be
stolen. He's in an underground bunker permanently, mm-hmm. just 24/7.
And sorry, did we even talk about the man playing Omni-Man here? I can't recall if we mentioned him.
Oh, well, now he's here. Okay, yeah. J.K. Simmons, yes. Yeah.
I now have an appreciation for this man when I think I've only seen his roles in recent history.
Oh really?
Because I'm a newcomer to the aughts Spider-Man series, and when I played Portal 2 in 2011, I was like, oh, I know this is like a famous guy and he's doing a good job. But then I played Portal 2 again for a podcast last year, and I thought, this is J.K. Simmons, and I appreciate this role even more. He's a great voice actor.
No, J.K. is one of the best actors around. I was so happy when he got to win that Oscar for Whiplash. I think it gave people a lot more. Appreciation for him. I, as a viewer of the show Oz, when Oz was new, it was funny because J.K. Simmons, that was his first like big role where he plays one of the most evil characters in the show, a for real neo-Nazi. Like, and he plays this Nazi wonderfully. And he's playing that guy at the same time as he is the yellow M&M in commercials.
Wait a minute. So, sorry. You mentioned Yellow M&M. Those characters started off as John Lovitz and John Goodman, but they eventually got too expensive. So it's been Billy West and J.K. Simmons?
Yeah.
Yes, it's been J.K.
Wow.
Since then. Yeah. It's wild.
Is he still doing the Yellow M&M? I think the red one and the green one seem to get most of the speaking lines now, but I also don't see very many commercials, so.
I think so. I think he's still the Yellow M&M. Yeah. And the most recent M&M commercial I remember watching is where David Cross is the caramel M&M now, and so he's still there as yellow. But yeah, and then he's also, yes, J. Jonah Jameson. When he got cast as J. Jonah Jameson, I was excited because I already knew him from Oz, and I was like, whoa, he's going to be J.J. And there's a reason nobody else ever gets to play J.J. in a live-action movie, and they didn't recast, because there's nobody living who is better at being J. Jonah mm-hmm. Jameson.
And then The Simpsons just has him on the show as Jonah Jameson for like five or six episodes. They're like, well, that role was funny. Can you do it for us?
And now here he is the big, scary, mustachioed dad, Omni-Man. And he's great. I also love this scene shows that what home life is like for them, because he just pops in and like Debbie's not like worried. She's not scared. She's just like, I guess we're missing breakfast. Oh, well. Like, yeah. So, here's a big change, though. So, in the background where they're kissing, you may notice a painting in the background that has Korean script on it. According to the internet, it says, Annyeong, hello, in Korean, and that is their internal confirmation that Debbie, who was written to be white in the original series, is now a Korean-American, reflecting the casting of her actress as well, Sandra Oh, and also reflecting Stephen Yeun's ethnic background as well, which makes Mark Grayson now a, you know, biracial character who's half Viltrumite and half Korean-American.
Oh, yeah, and I did want to mention the name Grayson. I mean, that had to be taken from Dick Grayson, I assume, or like an homage or something. Or did it? It seems unlikely that Kirkman would just like, I definitely came up with that out of nowhere, out of the blue.
When you're making a superhero thing, I don't think you're pulling Grayson out of a hat. I feel like it's a direct reference.
Especially with him being a teenager and everything, you know, kind of like, you know, when Robin, before he was Nightwing, obviously was a teenager, so.
I couldn't find him literally saying that in an interview, but for sure it's from that. Same with like, I could not find one interview where he says, I liked Dragon Ball and I was inspired by the, like, you learn more about them soon in the series after this episode, but the Viltrumites are not unlike the Saiyans, I would say.
I only watched the one, and I'm going to watch more, but I was getting Saiyan vibes.
Or Saiyajin, if I want to be a super weeb about it.
Saiyajin.
So, but yeah, this is where we learn that Mark doesn't have powers. He's just a regular kid, and they're showing that there's a little tension here. Like, basically, it is a story of, like, he's a late bloomer, and his dad's kind of worried. Like, hey, we've also been there. you'll be a regular kid soon. Don't worry.
We all got our powers eventually.
Yeah.
And so we see that Mark can't fly, he can't do nothing. And then we also see another cool thing about, like, if you're dating Superman, he can fly you to, like, Germany for the afternoon and come right back. Like, it sounds pretty nice. We then cut to the high school. It is Reginald Vell Johnson High. That's the name of it in the comic. They draw the principal in the comic to look like Reginald Vell Johnson, the actor who played Carl Winslow. And yes, when the principal appears in the series eventually, it is Reginald Vell Johnson who voices him too.
God bless that man.
I appreciate that you can sort of take the joke about himself. I mean, not a mean joke. It's, you know, it's obviously, it's a, you know, nice spirited joke that, hey, yeah, they would maybe in this fictional world, you grew up in this town and they named the high school after you because you were a famous actor.
I'm happy he's still around.
He's a great, I love him. It's if you watch the movies that made us about Die Hard, he is one of the main guys they talk to, and he, like, takes them around where they filmed everything, and it's really, he's a lovable guy. You just want to hug him. He's one of those, like, sitcom dads you grew up with thinking, like, I wish you were my dad. So, yes, we see William appear here, too. This is his best friend in the comic, and he also is a little different because it took him about 5 years in the comics for them to decide William is gay, and he goes through kind of a coming out process that's actually pretty funny, the way they play it in the comic. I liked it, but it's 20 years later. William's just an out high school student. In 2003, it made sense to, like, well, obviously I'm not coming out until college, but he can be an out high school student now.
Yeah, and in, like, most media of this era, a character being gay was kind of like an Easter egg you had to find. Like, if you look closely in the background, you'll see this rainbow pin, and that could indicate something to some readers, not all of them.
He has a Mapplethorpe book on his bookshelf.
Yeah. It's funny to see how it's written, too, because Mark is trying to say, like, Omni-Man was there, too, because he's trying to say, like, my dad's cool. Don't forget about my cool dad. But William doesn't know his dad's Omni-Man. So then he's like, geez, you really like Omni-Man. But I agree, he's hot as hell. Like, this must. And then William thinks that Mark is uncomfortable because he's like, oh, you're talking about gay stuff. I'm a straight guy, uncomfortable with that. When he's like, no, you're telling me how hot you think my dad is. That's why I'm uncomfortable. But yeah, William's a lot of fun. Andrew Rannells also. I talked about it before in another episode. Some of his first jobs were on the 4Kids dubs and Pokemon Live, the live show.
Oh, wow. Hey, we mentioned One Piece. Was he doing anything in that One Piece dub that nobody likes?
No, unfortunately, I think by like 2003, he had gotten successful enough to not need to do 4Kids. So.
Oh, good for him.
You can hear him in some Yu-Gi-Oh! I watched an interview with him where somebody showed a picture of him from Pokemon Live, and then he's like, oh my God. He says, I wish I'd have done porn or a snuff film when I was that age instead of Pokemon Live. Also, Mark is a true comic fan because he says he has to do his part-time job because when it's an event comic with bi-weekly releases in the summer, it costs a lot more money and you need to save up that money. I have been there.
I wasn't a comic reader for that long, but I remember at a certain point around the time the movie came out, Spawn became a twice a month comic with like two different teams, and I thought like, "Ooh, I got a scrimp and save for my Spawn budget."
Mow some more lawns.
Mm-hmm.
So here's another change from the comic. They don't introduce Amber as early as this, but Amber is a major character in the comic. But I'd say they've written her character a lot deeper in this new version. And also, originally the character is a blonde white woman. Now the character is black and voiced by Zazie Beetz, who, again, great, great actress. And I like this exchange here. They change this up a little bit to where Mark does try to help somebody in the comic, and then a bully beats him up. A bully who's just drawn to be Flash Thompson from Spider-Man as well. Spider-Man's childhood bully. But then he gets his ass beat because he's trying to act like his dad. It's a really good line. Like, William tells him, "Hey, you're not Omni-Man." And then he's like, "Oh, yeah?" Like, he wants to be his dad so bad. But yes, let's hear a little bit of William and Amber.
And Omni-Man was there too.
You're such an Omni-maniac. Way to root for the underdog. Big fan of the Yankees, are you? Sure, he's hot and all. And that mustache. Sorry, okay, straight stuff. You up for some Clash Crash tonight? I'm hoping for a level 43 chest armor. Don't bring up that stupid job, man. Don't be that person.
When's the last time you bought a comic book?
Those things are expensive. And they're doing Seance Dog twice a month, all summer. You're into the stupidest stuff.
Knock it off, Todd.
Come on. Quit playing games. I know you're crazy about me. Marcy told me.
Well, you are big and strong, aren't you?
You know it.
And you think that makes it okay for you to harass me?
Don't walk away from me. What, are you a lesbian or something?
Oh, my God, I wish. Would you leave me alone then? Let go of me so I can go find a girl to kiss.
He gets his butt kicked. Also, like, again, these are all the things. This is why I became a Spider-Man fan, because I saw Spider-Man bullied, and then he gets his superpowers, and that when you're a 10-year-old nerd with glasses just like Spider-Man, you really enjoy that stuff.
I really want to know if the video game reference was different in 2003, because they're clearly doing, like, Diablo or Fortnite or something. This Clash Crash thing.
I don't think the online gaming wasn't as strong back then. I think it was more like they were going to play Halo-ish together in person.
Mm.
And so this is when Mark gets his butt kicked, and then we cut to him at his job at Burger Mart, the McDonald's equivalent in this universe. And this walk to the dumpster, I did this a million times when I worked at AMC Theaters at this. I know the smell. When I see him walk into that dumpster with those garbage bags, I can smell it. I can feel the bag in my hand. It's horrible, horrible.
It's so gross. I worked in a few restaurants in the kitchen, and this bag just full of whatever random food and grease got in there, and it's always dripping everywhere, no matter what you do. It's the only worst job and then empty the trash was occasionally I'd have to empty out the grease traps from the deep fryers and bring that out. We had like a big thing on wheels that was full of the old used grease. You have to dump it up into a big barrel in the back near the dumpster so the Homer Simpson and Son grease recyclers would come and pick it up.
The grease men are here. I did some time at Taco Bell, 5 years, sorry, no, five weeks of hard labor at Taco Bell. Thankfully, it was a very tiny Taco Bell, so the trash walk was not very long. I will say that when I worked at a mall, at a retail store, the trash walk was quite long. You had to go through all these spooky mall hallways, like, between the stores.
Yeah.
It was nice. It was a nice break, but when you're doing it at night, you're like, wow, I could be murdered so many places here.
God. And that's, this is fun with this Burger Mart scene, too, because this is another one of these moments where Kirkman cutely subverts expectations. In the comics, he just tosses one bag and it flies in the air, and that's how he knows he has his powers. And he even says, about time. But in the show, he's got two bags. He puts one in the trash, and it's a struggle. And I think that's for viewers who are like, oh, boy, he's going to throw that trash bag in the air. And then he doesn't, and you're like, wait, what the hell's going on? And then he throws the second one.
Yeah, he's really looking at it manifested when throwing a trash bag when no one's around, and not, you know, when he was trying to fight the bully earlier, and like maybe right then and there, it manifested, his fist went through his skull or something.
Yeah.
Or say when he's on the toilet, I would think he can probably, like, if he pooped really hard, that might have destroyed the toilet.
I don't want that to be my origin story.
They put that in every superhero movie. I mean, like Spider-Man, oh, my hands are sticking to everything type deal. Or that very silly scene in Wolverine Origins where he pops his claws for the first time and he just cuts everything in the bathroom. But yes, here, Mark comes home and it's another cute thing where he's just like, oh yeah, I got a secret to tell. Like, you know, what happened to me today? Oh, well, I just got superpowers. That's all. And it's really cool how I like how Nolan is in shock and then has to be reminded, like, hey, tell him you're proud. Tell him you're proud. And he's like, oh, well, we're going to basically then tells him we're going to start practicing driving tomorrow.
Yeah, I love this stuff where, yeah, you're right. That's the analogy or metaphor or whatever that I came up with where, yeah, the flying is just like you're in your dad's car and he's sitting next to you and he's giving you all of this information and you're just trying to not kill yourself and presumably him too.
No, yeah, that's the great, when they're doing the flying practice later, it definitely felt like when my mom was taking me through my first driving lessons where she's like, and slow down, and slow down. But this is when we get the flashback of how Mark was told about Viltrum, how he gets to learn his dad is a Superman. And another change in this is that Mark is wearing a Canada shirt in the flashback, which, again, I wonder if that is just a cute reference to where it is animated or a thing they have to do for Canadian tax benefits. So
at least one flag per 20 minutes.
It's a stereotype and it can kind of be kind of corny, but I love seeing that little leaf everywhere. You know, at McDonald's in Canada, they incorporate the leaf into the golden arches just to let you know where you are.
I bought a hat when I went to Vancouver that's Vancouver, BC with a leaf on it. I always love wearing that hat. Slightly spoilery for the rest of season one, but obviously when you see this Viltrum stuff, you learn this is a lie he's telling his kid, and he's when you see what it really is, that's where it feels the most like Planet Saiyan and the Saiyan people. But again, I saw Kirkman never in any interview talked about Dragon Ball or even loving Japanese comics all that much. I mean, he likes them fine, but he also said a thing that definitely made me feel like he is not a guy who grew up with anime, because somebody asked him, like, hey, you know, you have all this violence, not a lot of nudity in your show. And he said, hey, you know what? I think animated nudity doesn't really work for me anyway. And I was like, well, you did not grow up with anime, man.
He's really on the cusp of the generation where you could just not have seen anime or just think it's all porn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, no matter what your sexual orientation, if you grew up with anime in the 90s, you know that animated nudity works indeed, Robert Kirkman. It works. I also really love how when Mark is a kid, learns all this stuff, his reaction is like, I'm going to be able to fly. And then it cuts back to him going like, because he can't sleep, because he's been dreaming of flying and being like his dad his whole life. This kid's so dad-pilled. But he like loves his dad or something. What is
weird.
This?
Gross.
Kirkman did like pull this kind of from his real life too, of like he... Because there was this expectation he was going to take over the family business. And so he thought, like, oh, what if your family business was being Superman? We then get some fun animation of Mark learning how to fly, almost hitting an airplane, which probably would have killed thousands of people, hundreds of people. So lucky that didn't happen. And also like that he stays up all night and then his dad, you know, again, it's just like, if you just learned how to drive or whatever, your dad's not going to you're not going to listen to your dad. You're going to wait to do it the next morning.
And he's still a half human, so oxygen is a concern. So he flies too high, and that's when he passes out. Which
yeah.
is, I like little realistic touches like that.
Yeah,
I appreciate that. He kind of figured out how to fly on his own, slightly, not very well, but he didn't quite figure out how to land on his own, how to stop flying. Which I think is that line mentioned later. It's like, oh yeah, it's falling down or landing is like peeing your pants on purpose or something. It's like you're doing the thing that your body is telling you not to do, but you have to. And to me, the idea of like flying continuously up into space and you couldn't stop, that is a horrifying idea. Like he could have just drifted off into space, died up there, because we do find out in a later episode, they do have to breathe in space. They're not immune to lack of oxygen, and that's it's just so horrifying. I've had weird dreams about that where, like, I can kind of jump, and I'm like, oh, I jumped too high, and I'm like, oh, no, I jumped too high. What's going to happen when I land? Oh, no.
He just, like, gets stuck. Yeah, I like this description of flying. Now, obviously, nobody in reality has ever flown, so you don't know what actually it is to make yourself fly, but the way Nolan describes it makes total sense, and J.K. Simmons sells this perfectly.
You can wear yourself out flying. Moving fast is like tensing a muscle. You're much better off if you relax that muscle from time to time. Use the momentum you're building to carry you forward. Okay, you don't want to fall, so you're going to have trouble relaxing. It's kind of like peeing your pants on purpose.
What?
Peeing your pants on purpose. You know, you spend your whole life trying not to pee your pants. So letting go, peeing your pants on purpose, it's next to impossible.
How do you know this? Who would try that?
You are far better at flying than you should be. Late night practice? Is that why you're so tired?
Don't try to change the subject.
It's, yes, peeing your pants on purpose again. It makes that same with how he says, like, well, you're like a baby. You know, you, after a while, you don't have to think about how to walk, but a baby does. And you're a baby flyer.
It's a good explanation. It did make me think a lot about peeing my pants, though.
Yes.
I'm thinking about it right now.
Well, that's what our we have previous Talking Simpsons guest stars who did this as a stunt. Our pals from Found Footage Fest.
Yes. Please check out their documentary Chop and Steal. You know, you'll understand what we're talking about. I have nothing but respect for people who are able to do that in front of an audience, in front of cameras. It's an ability that I don't have.
Their wonderful urine-based plan worked out, yes. Also then he's telling him how punching works in a superhero world. Like, if you can fly, you can create your own leverage. It makes you, like, stronger than other people. He's telling him how to fight, and this is when, you know, this is like your dad tells you, well, I'm going to teach you how to defend yourself. Come on, box with me. And then he is like, well, for training boxing, like, here's how you punch. And he punches him in the chest, and Mark is like, oh, my God, you've never, like he says later, you never punched me before, and it freaks me out. And this, again, foreshadowing for later, is about how, if you know what Nolan is thinking throughout this whole episode, what he's thinking is this changes things. When he says later, this changes things, like, he's thinking to himself, I have to kill the Guardians of the Globe for the next stage of this plan, and Mark getting powers fucks it up. He's also thinking, slight spoilers, but the way he was trained, he got beaten up by father figures all of the time. So when he just punches his son once and he's like, ow, Dad, he's probably thinking, like, I remember when I was beaten nearly to death in training.
Yeah, I mean, if you see what happens in the final scene, it makes a lot more sense when you see when his son gets the powers, the dad is not excited. He just is kind of like, I don't even know how to respond to this because I assumed it wasn't going to happen.
And even when he's talking with Debbie when they get back and she's going like, well, that went well, he's a jerk to her and she's like, hey, what the hell? Like, he's normally not like that. And he's like, well, it's maybe it would have been better if he didn't get powers. And then, you know, that's also a very real scene of like hearing your dad badmouth you and not realize you can hear him or just even, you know, just express normal regrets. And so then we cut to the school. This is also where he starts learning to, like, get punched because he just taunts his bully into punching him. And you know what? I got to say, this is one thing. They joke about this, I think, in other parts. But one, if you see Omni-Man on TV and then you see Mark's dad in person, you know he's Omni-Man.
Yeah.
You should, or you're stupid.
Yeah, I mean, the mustache is a dead giveaway.
Yeah, it should at least be a fake mustache you can put on and off.
And then secondly, if you see Mark taking punches full on and, like, not even bleed, like, look, somebody who's tough and be like, hey, punch me in the face, and then doesn't go down because they're trying to prove they're tough, their nose would still bleed. You would still see effects on them. But
like bruises, cut skin, yeah.
Yep.
I wish they didn't cut this one bit from the first comics that they could have put in this episode where the first villain Mark faces, is a guy who's like a teacher at the school. And when Mark and Adam Eve meet him, the teacher goes, "Oh, hey, Mark and Eve." And he's like, she's like, "How'd you figure out my secret identity?" And he says, "You're in my class and you don't even wear a mask. Like, come on." Like, yeah. But after Mark learns how to deal with bullies, then he really wants to punch somebody. So he puts on a half-form costume and goes on his first mission. And we then cut to the first guy he was really going to fight, which is a guy named Titan, a recurring guy in the comics, who I think is pretty cool. I love his powers are he has bulletproof skin, but it's that basically he puts on like a second skin of rock over his body when he activates his powers. And that's Oscar winner Mahershala Ali, who may appear in a Blade movie eventually. I don't know.
TBD?
Yeah.
The superhero show has been canceled for retooling.
Yeah. Hey, who could forget his voiceover-only performance in the stinger scene of everyone's favorite Marvel movie, The Eternals?
Yes.
Ooh, that's where that showed up. Okay.
Yep.
But they hadn't decided what he looks like at that point, so like, just record one line over the phone, please. And we'll talk to everybody's favorite character, the Black Knight. Everybody loves that guy. No, the Beast one in the Marvels, much better tease than at the end of Eternals. Though then again, some kids really love seeing Harry Styles playing Star Fox. Or I guess they're not, they can't call him, the character was Star Fox way before the Nintendo video games, but I guess they're going to have to call him just Eros or whatever.
Yeah.
Bob, did you know there's a superhero called Star Fox in Marvel Comics who dates back to the 70s?
No, I thought maybe that's why they had to call the game Star Wing in the UK, but then I remembered that, there was something called Star Vox in the UK. That's why they had to rename it, but weird. I say keep the name the same and make him just like the world's biggest Star Fox fan. That's where he got his name.
Mark, we have some great action here of Mark fighting this guy. I love how you can see that he's sort of flying erratically, but he uses that to his a help to smash into walls to wear him down. I also like how he's trying to think of his name. He's like, ass kicker? No, that sounds willfully childish. Like, but it's a really cool fight. And then once Omni-Man shows up, he's like, "Are you really proud of yourself?" Like, he's kind of giving him a guilt trip.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's seen that, like, basically he took the family car without asking, and he's in trouble now. It's also really good. Like, Steven Yeun plays it so great how he is, like, begging his dad to hit him just to prove he's strong. Like, I really like that, too. He's desperate for his dad's approval. This is when he finally decides, you know what, I'm going to help you out. And he takes him to another thing you always ask yourself about, who makes these costumes? Like, in Spider-Man movies, Spider-Man just makes them himself, which is like, no, you can't.
Yeah. How does a 17-year-old have sewing skills better than my grandma?
Yeah, like, this was probably in the comics around the same time as The Incredibles, right?
Yes, yeah.
Like, or probably right before The Incredibles.
Right before was when Art Rosenbaum was created, which I like. It's a fun two sides of it. So there's Edna Mode in The Incredibles, and she is like a fashionista like of the 60s and 70s who she views it as like dressing up supermodels. But in this case, you've got Art Rosenbaum, who basically is written to be a Jack Kirby type, like a Brooklynite older Jewish guy who designs all the coolest superhero costumes. I definitely think that's why he's written that way. And of course, though, he's voiced by another guy who's not unfamiliar to comic fans.
What do you think? Well, I don't know about the orange and yellow. It's pretty loud. Dad?
Not your best work, Art.
Can't blame a guy for trying to move unsold merchandise.
I like the goggles. They'd keep the wind out of my eyes when I fly. But I was really, like, hoping for something more, iconic?
Of course you were. That's what everyone wants. Iconic. A symbol. Something kids will draw on the margins of their notebooks while they daydream about being as cool as you. It's also tough as hell to pull off. But listen, your dad being who he is, I'm willing to put a lot of elbow grease into this one. But I'm going to need a little help from you. Have you decided on a name yet?
I haven't really thought about it.
Well, having a name helps. Darkwing has dark wings. The Red Rush is a Red Rush when he runs by you. You get it? You give me something to go on, I'll strive for iconic. Think about it and get back to me.
Yes, that's Mark Hamill, a.k.a. the Joker and Luke Skywalker.
You know what? I didn't recognize his voice, but I believe I did see him in the credits.
I didn't recognize it the first time I saw the episode, and then I think when I rewatched it for the second time, I'm like, wait a minute, is that who I think it is? And thanks to the Amazon X-ray feature, which, again, I think Bob, I can't remember if it was on mic or off mic, but we pointed out, like, yep, that's a good thing about the Amazon Prime video.
Yes.
The rest of it, yeah. Throw in the garbage.
Yeah, no. I wish other people could copy it on their streaming services, but I mean, it's not worth the extra $3 a month to get rid of it.
It is. They do. I mean, I don't want to like praise Amazon, but they do like pop up video style facts too. Like, oh, this scene was filmed blank, and then this happened. Just random little bits of trivia. I wish more sites could incorporate that, or more platforms could incorporate that.
Well, fortunately, they're able to leverage their ownership of IMDb to take a lot of that trivia just direct from IMDb.
That's right.
I was
going
to say, it's probably some kind of API called IMDb, and I didn't even realize Amazon owned them, too.
Amazon owns a lot of things. So you got Mark Hamill here, and I had a little tweet this weekend because I was trying to find out, like, oh, yeah, didn't I hear a story about why one of the things of how Mark Hamill was such a big comic nerd? And the story was, in 1987... he got to go to Jack Kirby's house and hang out with Jack Kirby all day and just ask him nerdy questions. It was so great. And also Bob Kane and Jerry Siegel were there as well. But I was like, boy, I got to find this picture of Mark Hamill at Jack Kirby. And sorry, it wasn't Jack Kirby's house. It was at Bill Mooney's house. Bill Mooney.
Oh, yeah. I saw that picture you put on Twitter. Reposted. Yeah.
But the crazy...
Of either...
Sorry.
Well, you can see, yeah, Bill Mooney of either Lost in Space fame or Babylon 5 fame, depending on how old and how much of a nerd you might be.
But craziest of all in the picture is, on the far right of the picture is Miguel Ferrer, who was the late character actor who you'd probably know best for being the snarky executive who creates RoboCop in RoboCop, or also from Twin Peaks. And I learned that he was also a giant comic book fan who wrote Marvel Comics right as he was taking off in his acting career in the late 80s. He did it for a few years. And if you like Spider-Man 2099, Miguel O'Hara, he's named Miguel because Miguel Ferrer was friends with the writer of the creator of the comic, Peter David. I learned all about Miguel Ferrer's background. But I also like that Art is saying, oh, yeah, you want just, like, an iconic suit that no one will ever forget? Boy, easy. I can do that for you. Also, it's an in-joke in the show that he's trying to sell his old costume. That is a costume that ends up on the character Bulletproof, so you learn later that superhero did just buy Art's leftover merchandise.
Not every superhero has a lot of money. Yeah. Actually, in the Season 2 Part 2 trailer that released a little while ago, I did catch that it showed a shot of that guy wearing that suit of Bulletproof.
Yep. Bulletproof's an interesting character. I like him. He's got an interesting background, but you'll learn about that later. Then we have also a new, this is a new scene they added from the comics because Debbie's character early in the comic, she barely has lines and she more is just like, she's the supportive wife who has no worries about her husband. And once his true nature is revealed, that's when she gets a little more deepened. But I think they're realizing, no, we need to show her relationship with Mark now. And it's a really touching scene of, like, first, Mark is basically like, hey, I'm a grown-up now, Mom. Make me clean my room. But I like how she deals with that. Like, she's not scared. She's like, does that make you feel strong? Is that what you need? Like, I like that.
It instantly debilitates him with shame.
Yeah.
The way only a mom can do.
Oh, yeah.
I love that Mark's a mama's boy because, yes, I like not exactly a mama's boy, but it shows why Mark has he's got a balanced thing. This is why Mark is a good guy. He's raised by Nolan, who's not actually a good guy, you learn, and then his mom, who actually is, you know, his heart. And it's funny, too, that she, like, rubs in. When he says, like, you know, you don't have powers, he's kind of telling her, like, you know, you're just a normal loser. He realizes that hurt her feelings. I love it. She says, I love my boring, powerless, everyday, run-of-the-mill mom, and I love my asshole son. And so then he's training, Mark and him are training, in another clever thing of throwing a ball They're playing catch back-to-back and throwing it in a around the world to each other.
That's great. Yeah, just taking the father-son rituals and just extrapolating them into the superhero context.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They're in the sky, and they're also throwing the ball around the world. That's great.
Yeah. So I tried to do some math, and I looked online. I checked my math, and I think I actually did my math correctly. So it is almost 18 seconds between one of them throws the ball, goes around the Earth, the other one catches it. Assuming they're at the actual diameter, they're not like slightly off to the side or something, and it would be less distance, the ball is going approximately 5 million miles an hour.
Which, nice.
Obviously, that would disintegrate the ball. Let's just say it's a ball from the planet Viltrum.
Yeah, it's a super ball made by
Titan. It's a super ball,
yeah,
because it does also go entirely through a mountain and keeps going.
Yes.
which means it had to actually been going a little bit faster than that to get slowed down by the mountain. So
oh,
it's going 5 million miles an hour. The speed of light is like 600 million miles an hour, so it's about 1/100th the speed of light.
That's pretty fast.
I hope they're checking flight paths before they do this.
Yeah, I think it does have a scene of it going by a plane. So that's the second plane almost destroyed just in this opening episode.
Yeah. Well, honestly, in a world like this show asks these questions, so I don't feel pedantic saying it. But if I lived in a world where, I don't know, dozens of people can fly and fight in the sky all the time,
mm-hmm.
airplane travel would actually be more dangerous than driving.
Trains are making a comeback.
Yeah.
Southwest, not cheap enough.
Spirit Airlines actually guarantees you'll be hit by a superpowered person.
and this is where Mark gets his idea.
Being a superhero is no different. This is the beginning of a long journey for you and me. Along the way, you're going to need to do things you don't want to do or might not think you can do. It's okay to be scared. It's natural to doubt yourself. But if you can push through that and do what needs to be done, you'll do just fine. You think you can do that, Mark?
Yeah.
Son, kids your age think they're invincible and it holds them back, makes them careless. The thing is, you're different. You actually are invincible.
Got it.
Okay, kid. Let's get to work.
He said the name of the show.
Oh, we did it.
Yes. Yeah, Bob. So then in the next scene, when the invincible is said again, that's when you get the title drop in the show, and it's one of the cleverest things about the show I really like, which is every episode, at some point when the name Invincible is said, that's when they blast it on the screen, and they don't have somebody say it. They just say, like, that's right, I'm Bloom. And not to spoil too much for anybody, but the season 2 premiere has the most fun with it, and it's really funny how they play on expectations. But that he flies straight there, gets his costume, and then we get the hero shot in his costume.
Mm-hmm.
You get to really soak it in. It's some great drawings. His costume is awesome. I love his costume because this was my favorite thing about it when it premiered. The Image logo had existed since 92, but it had never had anything in a comic that would really reference it. So Invincible, thanks to it being the letter I, it also is the Image logo. His suit is the yellow is the Image eye, so it actually makes him wear the Image Comics logo. It's so cool.
I feel like a moron for not thinking of that until you said it.
Same,
now it's
same.
So obvious. It's the lowercase I from Image Comics. Yeah.
Well, I've had 2 decades to think about it, so don't blame yourselves. But yeah, then we get just a big hero action-y montage just showing off how cool his flight is. It's animated wonderfully. That's where they get the Cage the Elephant song, Broken Boy. It's a lot of fun action of him flying. I like how you can see that he kind of like stops flying for a sec to drop a little bit and then restarts flying. Like it's really cool. The whole thing got boarded out by Chris Copeland of the Copeland Brothers, and it was just originally test footage, but then Kirkman liked it so much that he wrote the scene into the script.
Oh, nice.
So they could use it and put it in the show. And then as his action ends, He then comes up to the typical comic villain jobber in wrestling parlance, but basically in superhero comics, you need somebody that Spider-Man can beat in like 3 pages because they can't take the whole comic, but he needs like stop, the Rhino from robbing a bank and then get back to his story. And so that's what Kill Cannon is here. I also do like the Kill Cannon again. He's saying the thing you're thinking of, like, cops, you're not going to stop this guy, and he's just going to kill you. Like, run away, cops.
Yeah, there's like one of like 3 scenes in which it just shows how useless bullets are in this world.
Yeah, I think with all the super science, they'd at least give some cops, like, oh, you're the superhero cops, you get anti-superhero guns.
Though they have more answers of like, well, how do regular people stand up to this type of things? Once they introduce Walton Goggins' character, Cecil, who is the Nick Fury of this universe, but a little more, I'd say more morally gray than Nick Fury, just a little bit. Yeah. Yes, this is when, as Mark's fighting the guy and beating the crap out of him, well, we get our title drop for the first time.
You might as well give up. I'm...
And that's basically your opening music there. Yeah. And the opening comes at 30 minutes into the episode.
Such a Superman-esque fanfare, too, which I think is a nice touch.
It's really good. And the action is great. It's so much fun. And, yes, we get to see that Otley gets his co-creator status on the screen, which he should. He's, even though he came in a year into the book, he is just as much a creator of the book as Corey Walker is. So then, with 8 minutes left in the show, this is where they're throwing a surprise at you. And so this basically is a very direct adaptation of issue 7, which is there's no Mark in it, and you just get to see a little bit of each of the Guardians of the Globe. And this is pretty much ripped straight from the comic page. Like, you get to see the Red Russian, who, once you hear him talk more, you're like, oh, he's Russian. That's why Red Rush, Red Russian.
To go back to him, I do like how, again, taking a stock idea and applying it to superheroes, the having to be in 2 places at once kind of sitcom idea, where it's like, I got to be on this date, but I also have to run over here. But it's happening like mid-conversation.
And also taking the idea of like, if you could move at the speed of light, what is thought to you? What is vision?
It reminds me, there's a panel, I wish I knew what issue it's from, but I think it's Quicksilver talking to like a therapist or something and an X-Men comic. The therapist is like, well, why are you such an asshole all the time? And Quicksilver's like, have you ever been stuck behind someone who's really slow at the bank or on the sidewalk? That is my life 24/7 times 1,000. I'm constantly stuck, feeling like I'm stuck behind someone who's walking slow on the sidewalk. And it's, imagine how frustrating that would be living like that. So it does sort of go that, like, their thoughts are going as fast as their body sometimes. And it's got to be pretty frustrating.
Like him saying, like, this conversation with you feels like an hours to me. Mm-hmm. Like, this is,
It's kind of like a mean thing to say, I think. Then he has to sort of, like, walk it back later. He's like, but that's a good thing, because I love you.
It also feels like, I don't know, how you see people with ADHD describe that as well, of just like, it's hard to focus, and I'm trying my best, and I love you, but I have trouble focusing, like that, except this guy is the Flash.
Yeah.
And then we cut to the Immortal, who has one of my all-time favorite lines in the show, which is always true. It is in the comic, too. He's fighting a guy who is essentially the Spider-Man villain, the Vulture, and he's just like, the Vulture is saying, I'm going to blow up this whole city, throws the guy into space, and then he says, when in doubt, throw him into space. Like,
yep.
And I assume he killed that man.
He didn't look like he was wearing a spacesuit of any kind.
No.
I think he was on his way to, like, suicide bomb whatever what the target was anyway, so.
Yeah,
he had made his peace already.
And then we cut to Aquarius, and so look, even 20 years ago, making fun of Aquaman was pretty standard, so I get it. The joke here is he's just a fish guy who lives underwater and waits for the Justice League to call him. But I wonder how it is for, especially if you're a prime video viewer of superhero things, because 20% of the boys is making fun of their Aquaman. So this maybe feels like old news to you watching this show.
Yeah, like, and I guess DC has rehabilitated that character. Although I heard that second movie stinks.
I heard that's too.
Aquaman fish pun.
It's a day old fish. Wrap it up.
Yeah,
yeah.
But yeah, like we're used to this, and yeah, that's why like even going back to like SpongeBob, they have Aquaman parodies.
Yeah, Mermaid Man is also again. It's like this guy's. It goes all the way back to Super Friends, because the kids who grew up watching Super Friends would say to themselves, Aquaman is useless in this show. Why are we watching this guy?
And growing up, we had our own Aquaman, Mati from Captain Planet,
oh,
with the power of heart. Nobody wanted to be that guy when we're playing Captain Planet on the playground.
I didn't understand why he didn't use the heart power on the villains. Oh, you're evil? Da-da-da-da-da. There you go. Heart, you're good now. Get out of here.
Gaia nerfed that ring. It was too powerful.
Yeah, it's like, no, it's not. Yeah, I mean, I always thought like as a kid too, just like not realizing that heart means like empathy, that it means like, yes, control someone's emotions. Do that with the heart.
It was really just the animal ring, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's usually used just to have animals do something for them.
Poor Mati. You know, now you're sadly reminding me of like, it was such a joke with our generation that I wasn't a viewer. I only know it from watching videos making fun of it. But that guy with the glasses, Nostalgia Critic, I think even had many episodes making fun of Mati of his show.
I think voiced by Scott Menville, if I'm not mistaken. I could be mistaken.
Oh, in the original Captain Planet? Yeah. Who wouldn't be doing it if they made a new Captain Planet?
No, let's hope they don't.
No. But yeah, so then we go from Aquarius. So we saw Red Rush, then Immortal, then Aquarius. Then we go to War Woman, who is... So in the comic, they make it very clear that War Woman dates another woman. And then, like, again, I think they undersell that as well, because that is a major part of the boys, is that their Wonder Woman dates a woman as well, secretly.
Yes, I think she has to do it secretly, then later, because the boys is... In addition to being about what if superheroes were dicks, it was, what if Disney was also actually a global arms producer and used their superheroes as actual superheroes around the world. So it's like, oh, when they find out about it, it's all perfect. We can actually, you know, capitalize on this now. You're going to start a bunch
rainbow
of...
Rainbow washing yourself.
Commercials, rainbow everything. Yeah, and then it's like, okay, great. My relationship is just a marketing tool now.
That's one of my favorite lines is when they're talking to the Wonder Woman stand-in and her girlfriend and saying like, so yeah, you're going to come out and you're just going to be a proud lesbian. And then her girlfriend says she's bi. And then the marketers go like, you know, that complicates it. You know,
that doesn't sell as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Though, of course, when Eric Larson drew the page introducing War Woman in the original comic, she wakes up in bed sleeping in the nude and then walks around naked for a few. Just to let you know, Eric Larson's drawing it. He's like, well, can she be naked on this page?
Yeah, somebody, I think it was Retronauts co-host Stuart Gipp, posted this like very weird Savage Dragon page on Twitter. But then I'm like, I bet there's 300 of these pages that are just as weird. Where they meet Mickey Mouse and Mickey Mouse wants to have a threesome. And he...
Yep. Yeah,
with Savage Dragon and his wife or something, or they want to see, wants to swap wives with them, and then there's a reference to Mickey seeing a video of Savage Dragon's wife doing something, and it's
Hey, not to derail the Savage Dragon stuff, but there's a long story where Savage Dragon's son, who becomes the next Savage Dragon, him and his girlfriend have sex with his adopted sister. And I was just like, okay, Eric Larson, I get, like, you don't have to put your Pornhub search results in here.
You know, digital art has made it much easier for Eric Larson to literally draw the comic with his penis. He couldn't do that before.
But so in this case, though, the War Woman origin is just, basically, she's a girl boss who works for Ubisoft and flies off from her meeting.
Hey, yeah, and she cares about the workers. No wonder she is turned into goo.
Yep.
Yeah. Then we cut over to Martian Man practicing his stretchiness. And it also is important to show that basically there's like a little zit in the middle of his goo. That's like his brain, which that's how Omni-Man kills him later, as he rips open that little part. Yeah. We also have a fun misdirect that you're wondering who the Green Ghost is, and you see like a supermodel in green, but then you learn, no, it's the woman photographer of them. And also, unlike Green Lantern, who wears a ring, you swallow a jewel to become the Green
Giant
Lantern.
Giant horsepill-sized jewel.
Yeah, it's like, I don't want that. I hate taking, like, the giant DayQuil capsules. That's bad enough.
Good news! It's a suppository.
Oh, can you do that? Can you stick the jewel in there?
Well, that's a good question.
In the comic, they do a joke where Green Ghost, in the middle of the fight, accidentally pukes it out. Or in the middle of a fight, pukes it out. And then they say, you got to get back in the fight. And then Green Ghost has to go like, I guess I got to swallow it again. And has to swallow the thing they just barfed out. And we see a little bit of Darkwing beating the shit out of some guys. So he leaves those guys and said, I'll see you in the morning. So I assume those guys starved to death or they never got freed. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, again, mild spoiler, but it's more of a quick joke. In season two, we briefly see two skeletons hanging up on that building in a quick blink and you miss it scene.
So, yeah, these guys were inadvertently killed. So then everybody ends up at the mountain hideout and they're wondering who called them there. So this is the big change, the last big change from the comics. And it's very useful, I'd say, to make this a TV show, which is in the comic page, there are two pages left, and you're like, so who called them all here? Then in one page, in five panels, everyone is killed, and there's not a fight. It's just one dead, one dead, one dead, one dead. And then the last page is, who did it? Omni-Man. Now, that works great to shock you in the comic, but in the show, it is much more fun to watch a crazy, violent fight.
Yeah. Throughout the entire episode, I was like, well, I heard this is a very violent series, but they're really pulling their punches, and here's where they don't. But it's very important to show, like, this is just how powerful this guy is, even compared to other superheroes. And it's very effective, it's very gross, but ultimately it's there for a reason.
Heads explode like you're watching an anime from the 80s.
Yeah, it is brutal. And I could be wrong, but I seem to recall that when the show was first marketed, they were clearly marketing it as more like, oh, it's kind of like a Young Justice or a Justice League-esque show, maybe a little bit more edgy. But I don't think the original ads for it showed any of this hyper-violence. And they were definitely trying to fool a lot of people. And they fooled me because I had heard of the Invincible comic, but I did not know it was that hyper-violent. I'm just like, okay. And then I was watching it. I had kind of the same reaction as Bob. I'm like, oh, I had read this comic was supposed to be more brutal than this. And then it's over. And then, of course, it does the quick... You know, they fools you. Oh, there's like two credits. Oh, back in the show. And then we get the payoff. And then every other episode after this is pretty much living up to those expectations that you would expect it to have.
Brains are exploding everywhere. Intestines. Like, it's disgusting amount of detail. It's so, and Ryan Ottley talked about this in an interview about, like, why is it so violent? He's like, because I love drawing violence. He said he grew up reading comics. And thinking, like, why doesn't Wolverine stab these guys? Why doesn't Ninja Turtle stab these guys? And now he finally gets to draw what he wanted.
Oh, they're sure fighting an awful lot of robots in these comics.
And it's not like, I will say that the pacing of the fight is done very well. Where, you know, certain guys are taken out. We're not going to go over every, like, move of the fight, I don't think. But certain of his opponents are taken out. And then it seems like at a certain point he will be defeated, Omni-Man, because he is being teamed up against by the remaining heroes. But no, he is that strong.
Yeah. Well, and you talk about it strategically. Yeah, the first guy he takes out is Red Rush because he's about to kill all these people, and then Red Rush stops him and saves them. So that's why then the first guy he kills and explodes his head in insane detail is Red Rush.
And just the ineffectual punching and flailing Red Rush is doing, and where you can see he's breaking his own wrists in any attempt to try and get Omni-Man to let go of him, and just ineffectual.
And just as I did slightly in the monorail episode, this also follows the rule of the Flash is faster than Superman, but it doesn't really matter. But yeah, he's killing everybody. They don't know what's happening. They think, is he mind controlled? Because, you know, that happens in comics all the time. The way he kills Batman is exactly how it would go in his fight where Superman doesn't care. He just grabs him by the foot, smashes him on the ground once, and his brains explode out of his head from the impact.
He just does, like, the Bam Bam maneuver.
Yeah.
Fred Flintstone doesn't explode into a pile of gore.
No.
And he takes War Woman's cudgel and just hits the head off of Aquarius, the Aquaman guy.
Oh, it's so brutal. And as far as I know, Aquarius's powers, it's just summoning water spouts. And I guess you can breathe underwater, too. But we don't see him have, you know, any kind of super strength or whatever. I guess that water seemed pretty powerful because it was slightly slowing down Omni-Man.
It held him back, yeah. But he rips apart everybody in short order. When you see this, too, you should not be surprised that Omni-Man became a Mortal Kombat DLC character.
Yeah.
And he does all this stuff in the game. Yeah.
When I was looking up J.K. Simmons' role to see what I had seen him in, I did see Mortal Kombat, what was it called? Mortal Kombat 1? Is that what it's called then?
Mortal Kombat 1.
Yeah.
Yes.
Not confusing at all.
Only the second time they restarted the account, I think.
Yeah. No, he's one of the guest characters in Mortal Kombat 1. It's him and the lead villain of The Boys who are both Superman stand-ins. So it's like two evil Supermen from Prime Video series in the same game.
Yeah. Jeff Bezos is sending us signals.
Signals he's about to buy the Mortal Kombat franchise from an impoverished Warner Brothers. And then he kills everybody. Nobody knows why he did it. And then they just go like, why? Cut to black. And again, Kirkman said this in the interview. He learned from in the comics that they waited maybe almost too long to reveal the twist, and that it almost made the comic not sell enough to continue existing long enough to sell the twist. So when he writes episode one, he's like, I certainly cannot expect fickle streaming viewers to wait for the fourth episode or whatever for this reveal. It's got to be the first episode.
And I think they made the smart decision that it's like a fake post-credit scene. Because I think, I said before, it's the credits flash on screen for like 2 seconds before it goes. So it's quick enough that unless you're the fastest person, you have the remote in your hand, you're going to know that the episode keeps going. I think I did see one post somewhere where someone's like, oh, there's a post-credit scene?
Yes.
I mean, you weren't clued in the fact that there's 15 minutes left?
If I could complain about a Prime Video again, they are one of the worst of next episode. Like, Netflix isn't even this aggressive of autoplay the next episode. But Bob didn't have to suffer through that.
No, I was not faked out. Although, actually, I was faked out. When the title card happened, I was like, oh, that was a fast 44 minutes. And then I saw, oh, no, there's more show. I looked down that little bar.
And that's kind of how the show goes of, like, they'll put those credits anywhere in the episode, and then you wait and see what's going to happen after. You can never – it's always got you on your toes. It's a cool thing they do even into the newest season, which I didn't even say. Also, where this is great timing for covering this because the second half of season two is about to premiere this month when you're listening to this new.
Yep, looking forward to it.
Yeah, but it was a great first episode to introduce you to the world of Invincible. It foreshadows things better than the original comics do because they know where they're going. And I just love the cast, and I'd say the action is great. I've seen some people complain that maybe the coloring is a little flat, but that's just how these type of things look. But
yeah, I think it's just keeping a comic book style, which would also have similar coloring.
Yeah, I really like this. I wanted to watch more, but I'll tell you when we're recording this. I'm getting through Dune, so I spent the past 4 days reading 400 pages of Dune instead of doing anything else. But I do want to watch through this with my wife because I was very impressed by the first episode, despite having reservations because all I heard people talk about was the extreme violence, and I didn't know that it was all fully justified and had a point. So, very impressed by this. And even though, again, it's on the same page as the early odd superhero commentators are on, like Venture Brothers and Incredibles and The Boys and everything, I think it has its own point of view. And it's not like derivative. I just think everyone arrived at these points at the same time and wanted to explore them at the same time. So thumbs up for Invincible.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
But so thank you, Andrew, so much for picking this one out and giving us a chance to talk about a show that's only 2 years old instead of 10 times that.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. So it's kind of it's going with the theme. I did American Dad new, so I catch old. Invincible new, so I guess next one's got to be an old one to keep up with the pacing.
We're going to enforce that rule right now on the show.
Shoot.
If not, we're going to keep Andrew's money.
My money.
But no, thank you so much again, Andrew, for the great pick.
Yeah.
Thanks again for having me, guys.
Thank you, Andrew. So that has been another episode of What a Cartoon. Thanks so much to Andrew for sponsoring this episode. It was a great one. And if you want to be cool like Andrew and support our show, please head on over to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons and sign up for $5 a month. For that small, small price, it'll get you over 150 full-length miniseries episodes that you have not heard if you're not a patron. We've covered things like Mission Hill, Batman the Animated Series, The Critic, Futurama, and King of the Hill. You'll get all of those we've done to date over, almost 7 years worth of miniseries episodes the second you sign up. And also, when you sign up, you will get new episodes of both Talking Futurama and Talking of the Hill every month. Again, just $5 only at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons, and there is a $10 level as well. When you sign up for that, you can access all of the $5 stuff naturally, but then you can also access one mega-long podcast once a month, only for patrons of that level or higher. And what is that, Henry?
Bob is talking about our What a Cartoon movie podcast, where we cover an animated feature film as in-depth as we do an episode of Invincible, which often means talking for 4, 5, or even 6 hours. You get to hear a little bit of it every month in this free feed for What a Cartoon. But if you want to hear the full thing, like our most recent one about Porco Rosso that was nearly 6 hours long, you need to sign up at the $10 level. Also, if you loved all this superhero talk, we've covered a lot of superhero films, mostly Batman. We did Batman Beyond, The Return of the Joker, Batman and Superman, World's Finest, The Batman, Mask of the Phantasm, as well as Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, and tons of other awesome stuff. At the end of this month, you're going to hear us also talk about another thing we love, bad animated movies, or less liked at least, like Chicken Little from Disney. And you can hear all of that and the $5 things Bob just mentioned if you sign up at the $10 level. Once more, that is at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons.
And I've been one of your hosts, Bob Mackey. You can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. My other podcast is Retronauts, the classic gaming podcast all about old video games. You can find Retronauts wherever you find podcasts, or go to patreon.com/retronauts and sign up there for 2 full-length bonus episodes every month. And Henry, how about you?
Follow me on Twitter at HENEREYG. I am always tweeting up a storm. Keep up with your Henry Gilbert updates there, or on Instagram as Talking Henry. And also, if you're following us on social media, please follow the official account at TalkSimpsonsPod, because at TalkSimpsonsPod keeps you up to date whenever there's new podcasts, new things on the Patreon, all the cool stuff we do. You know about it first if you follow at TalkSimpsonsPod. And if you need an easy-to-explore list of all of our previously released free podcasts, head over to TalkingSimpsons.com.
Thanks so much for listening, folks. We'll see you again next time for an extended free preview of our What a Cartoon Movie episode all about Disney's Chicken Little, and we'll see you then.
Bye, have fun.
I'll just be walking on the ground with my feet.